up, people? Welcome to a very special episode. I'm Dylan Fox, and we are talking about the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. I did it already. I talked with someone else about it. I talked with Case Lowe about it. But I'm not done with the Hall of Fame yet. We have a bunch of other regions to go through. Plus, I'm probably just going to worm Japan into all of the shows, so don't worry about it, because that's what we're all about in the Eastern Lariat. And today, I got a very special guest, another first-time voter, too. We've got people that can influence the balloting, and somebody who's proven very, very influential in his own right. That's a big part of the ballot. He is a longtime friend of mine. I really respect him a lot. Longtime member of the Eastern Lariat family and the co-host of the Emerald Flow Show on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. I'm so happy to do a show with my man, Gerard Detrolio. How's things going, man?
Hey, Dylan. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be on the Eastern Lariat for the first time, I guess. Now I'm jumping over to your show. And I am so pumped right now to talk about this Hall of Fame.
That's true. I was on the Emerald Flow Show as well a few months back, actually. I came in, I think, as an emergency guest. I think you were up against the wall, and I was probably like your last candidate, but I was the only one around. So
you were my first.
Okay.
It was Paul, like something came up at the last minute, so I only had a short amount of time to turn around, but you're the first person I went.
Well, I appreciate that, Gerard. I had a lot of fun on the show, too. I know I blew your mind when I said Yuma was getting booked like Kaito. And now he's even lower than Kaito a few months later. So it's funny how times change. But still love them both, by the way. That's no slight on them as wrestlers. We will talk about Kaito in a week or two about Noah. See what's happening with him with his title match coming up. It should be very fun. But today we're talking about some legendary candidates. And I think if you know me, we've done on the Patreon a big show on Inoki, 7-part series, Week of Lariat, 7 matches with Inoki. I did the long Inoki show with Kench Stalker. That was a crazy amount of work was put into that. I did the show with Case. We talked a little bit about U.S., a lot about Japan. And today, like I said, Gerard, you've got a vote for the first time. Congratulations for that, by the way. Dave Meltzer, he respects you. He's a Gerard respector that has been proven. And your first move, so to speak, in the Observer candidacy was to write an article on Sanshiro Takagi. You're trying to get him in the Hall of Fame. I know what you were doing. I know you were trying to make my head pop a little bit here. But you, I really associate with the non-wrestler category, and that's why I had you on today. So we're going to go through all the non-wrestler categories, but we are going to pop around the other ones, because you're not just voting on one category. You're voting on all of the other ones. And I think that over the years, I said this on the other show, the real value of the Observer Hall of Fame is not just the inductions themselves, but actually the discussion that comes along with it and the fun we could have talking about people that we're probably not going to get the chance to on a regular basis, but we can in this unique way. So I will say this, Gerard, when I look at the ballot and when I look at the Hall of Fame itself, you know, I see the voters and the way things work. So I'm going to lay down the rules a little bit. Basically, this year they changed things up to where they limited it to 5 candidates in each region, except for the historical region, which is a bunch of older people. You can vote up to 8 there. But everything else is 5. And then you get some non-wrestlers who don't even count as a part of the other ones. So you can vote for a bunch of different people pretty much by the end of it. But you have to limit it in each category. So with that said, each performer to get inducted into the Hall of Fame needs 60% of the votes at least, so a good majority. I know Dave really kind of based a lot of this on the Baseball Hall of Fame, which has its pros and cons. I think he's been tweaking it a good bit over the years. We've seen different changes and things like that. But when you look at the ballot overall, before we get to the individual performers, how do you feel about the strength of the ballot, the process, and everything that goes along with the Hall of Fame itself? Because I think there's a lot of different interesting things when it comes to it. How do you think of the format? Was there anything that you think could be changed that maybe in the coming years, maybe you could have a tweak or two here and there that might make it a little bit better, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think for the most part, I don't have a problem with the sort of emergence of the tag teams that he's now decided to come up with. I think there's certain acts that couldn't get in there on their own, but they really did sort of change wrestling because of the tag team that they were in. I think giving more votes in the historical category makes sense because you're getting a lot of traffic jam in there. Although I'm wondering if the five votes everywhere else is going to cause more traffic jams like we had in Lucha for so.
Yeah, that's true. Lucha did have a big long-term... me and Fredo would talk about this all the time, in the past years, because he's been a voter for a long time now. And we'd be like, man, Lucha's getting screwed. We never get anybody in on here. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but I could see it. It's going to be interesting because this is the first time for the new version. And like you said, there was an emergence for a ton of tag teams coming in both the U.S. and the Japan candidacy. And even Mexico had Octagon and Yota Sant on there. So we are seeing that. It seemed like that was a focus for this year's balloting. And like I said, before we start talking about everybody, for you, because I think everybody has a different kind of way of looking at things they value. Because on paper, it said that there's three kind of major subjects you look at. The drawing power and star power is one. The in-ring, purely in-ring, is two. And the third is legacy and influence. So basically Dave explains that if you've got two of the three at a really Hall of Fame level or one at like a super, super high undeniable level, you can vote for them. Like they're eligible or whatever, in your opinion, of course. So what, as a voter, what do you look at? Is there a certain way of looking at somebody that you're like, hey, this is what I value and this is what I will look for in the Hall of Fame above the others?
Well, let's be honest here. Like, drawing is the most easily quantifiable out of all three. And I think that's really what people default to. And it's what I look for, because when I go into cage match looking up some of these older names, I'm looking to see if I can get attendances, because that's the easiest first thing to start with. I think most people can at least acknowledge historical influence or whatever, although I've seen that debated about certain wrestlers. And people will get into arguments over work rate or, you know, in-ring skill or talent, although I'm not against, as we'll get into later, like voting for some incredible, overwhelming in-ring performance.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from at that, you know, because I agree with you that this star power deal is probably more easily quantifiable than an in-ring, because, like, you know, I could say, oh, you know, Jay White sucks, and you could be like, oh, Jay White's awesome, and there's no real way we can prove it, you know, definitively one way or the other, more so than just our opinions. With a drawing record, you can kind of point to that more easily, and I think influence even is probably a little bit more, you can point, if you have a good eye, you can point to stuff like that as well. The good thing, or not the good thing, really, the interesting thing about all of this is that the Observer, they've listed it as one of their requirements is the 35-year-old and 10-year eligible, like 10 years wrestling active eligible. I really wish personally they would move some of these people up, because to me, I'm with you, but I also think not just drawing power like in the numbers, but I also think star power, and it's especially in the Japanese region, there's a lot of guys on here that you can point to, and there's nothing against them, and if maybe if 10 years were passed, we would be easier to vote for them. But to me, I look at so-and-so, and which probably some people were about to talk about, and I'm like, well, this guy's not really a legend. Like, you know, like he's still active. He could be adding on to his candidacy. I really wish that we could see that and have a little bit more time to breathe, because I think that that's another thing you can point to. You know, listen, you can have the greatest matches and be a big star in your time, but if 5 years goes by and you've left and you've been forgotten about, that doesn't say a lot about you as a Hall of Famer, in my opinion. You know, I think that's something we need time on, in my opinion. So that's something I value, is like legacy and things like that. That's not even in the candidacy notes or anything like that. That's not even a category. But to me, that's like a feel I have. Is like, if somebody's a legend, that goes a long way with me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I really wouldn't have a problem with it going to 40 or 5.
Yeah, I think that would be the ideal one, in my
opinion. But at the same time, like, I don't necessarily think about it a lot either. I'm like, yeah, okay, right? So, but yeah, I mean, it would probably deter some traffic jams, though.
Yeah, see, so that's good stuff right there. But with that said, let's get into the non-wrestlers. And this one, it's different than the wrestler regions, right? Because it's not like you could say you know, so-and-so drew or anything like that. You obviously don't have work rate. Well, I mean, there is draws in terms of promoters and stuff that we'll get into with some of these guys. But they're all kind of linked together, and we're going to see how that plays out in the ballot as well. But I think for you, since you wrote the article about it, why don't you kick off with your guy? You have been advocating for him. You needed him to be on the ballot, and you accomplished that goal. I'm giving you the praise. I'm giving you the props. It was you that did it, Gerard. You have influenced the Hall of Fame already, so you've proven yourself as an influencer. What do you say about the candidacy of Sancho Takagi to those who maybe haven't read your article? Because it would be stupid if you wrote that whole article and then at the end we're like, nah, he's not really a Hall of Famer.
Well, I mean, basically, there's a couple of things here. First of all, DDT is celebrating their 25th anniversary. And yes, and we'll go into how much it really matters, but at the same time, like, Tokyo Joshi Pro will have the 10th anniversary of their first ever show next year, but it was, like, announced in 2012. So he's got, like, a longevity case, obviously, in a business where, you know, Jim Crockett Jr. was only a promoter for, like, 14 or 15 years. Bill Watts was only a promoter for, I think, 8 before, like, when he bought Mid-South to when he sold it to Crockett. Again, obviously, they were much larger business successes than Takagi has been. But someone like Don Owen in Portland, he got in there basically because he lasted 50 years. But he was never as influential within the United States as Takagi was in Japan. And to be honest, one of the reasons that Don Owen eventually got in is because he was beloved by all of the retired wrestlers that voted for him. He gave good payoffs. You know, famously, Roddy Piper, and this was during the height of Hulkamania, refused to work in the work WWF shows in the Portland territory out of respect for Don Owen. So that's sort of like the respect that he was getting from everything like that. But he doesn't really have any sort of business case, that sort of thing. So I think those sort of precedents had already been set. And there's the issue of, like, what Takagi has done. Like, he debuted in, like, some tiny indie, but I believe technically his first recorded match was in Pro Wrestling Crusaders, which is one of those, like, many promotions that was an offshoot of when SWS closed. He came together with several wrestlers, I think it was like Mikami and Sawa, and they formed DDT in 1997. Their first show was like this tiny show. I can't even remember where it was, but it wasn't even like they weren't even big enough to like debut in Korakuen or anything like that. And so 25 years later, he's built this huge company that has done, you know, more than shows drawing more than 10,000. Many shows drawing in the high four figures. He's done all sorts of very innovative promoting things. Like, you know, I didn't count this as a business case, but they had a match that they claimed drew 30,000, but it was at the Tokyo Ramen Festival. So there were thousands of people there, and sort of like, you know, DDT has definitely run like piggybacked off of like cultural event, public outdoor cultural events to do like matches and everything like that. I think what he's sort of doing with Wrestle Universe is innovative, although again, like that's not just him, but I mean, he oversees all of this. He's become arguably the second most powerful man in Japanese wrestling behind, I would say, Kidani at Bushiroad, the president of Cyber Fight. So he's overseeing Noah, Tokyo Joshi Pro, and DDT. Now, there's a couple of negatives that I can go into as well. First of all, obviously his style. Dylan, I know that you're not always the biggest fan stylistically of DDT. And I often agree with you on a lot of that stuff. People have called it a parody of pro wrestling. I don't necessarily think that should be held against him. That's something.
I think it would be more held against him. Yes, I'm not a big fan, not to cut you off, but they themselves basically marketed themselves as that, you know, when they were coming up, is that they were very easily influenced. Even something like the Iron Man heavy metalweight title was a parody of the hardcore 24/7 title in WWE. So it's like they kind of marketed that themselves. So, I mean, whether you're a fan or not, I don't think you can hold it against them when that was part of the, it's like they're part of their identity as a promotion almost.
They are the lasting legacy of the Attitude Era.
Well, hey, he's a stone cold
exactly.
pretty much.
But I mean, it's sort of funny because so much wrestling that is a product of their time, that like starts as a product of its time, doesn't last. But DDT has, which, you know, I think is impressive. And I think another thing that you could say is that DDT is not doing so hot in the pandemic, really. Their Corkins aren't drawing very well, like generally even less than All Japan. And that's, and they've obviously done like cheering Corkins where like obviously you can't put more than like 700 people in there, but there's been shows even during the pandemic that have underperformed comparatively to how many people you could get in the building. I'm thinking of that Endo and Ueno match earlier this year.
Oh yeah, that was
Yokohama Budokan.
Yeah, yeah.
And that didn't draw very well. So, I mean, you can say, like, maybe you want to kick the can down the road, see what happens when all restrictions are lifted and, you know, DDT can get some momentum back. But I think on the whole, he's already done enough and just sort of innovative. Basically, it's like he is so unique, no one else has done what he has done in Japanese wrestling or in pro wrestling anywhere, really. And I think... you know, I obviously Tokyo Joshi is much smaller than Stardom, but he's still like started the, well, not himself, obviously, but had a hand in, like, they're the number two company now. And I think they're in an upward trajectory too.
Yeah, you know, the thing with Tokyo Joshi Pro, they are the number two, and they started out, like, in a bar somewhere, pretty much, you know, like we're wrestling on the mats, like, there was four people in the first class, and they've grown to where they can run these bigger shows. They're not super successful. I think that's a mark against any of these new guys, or wrestlers in general, is that the pandemic-era restrictions and stuff throw a wrench into so many things, you know, at the end of the day, when it comes to the overall grand scheme of things, that is a little bit of a tough situation.
Yeah.
You know, let me ask you something here, because that's interesting, because we kind of mentioned both guys that I was going to point to when it comes to both him and Rossi, who we'll talk about in a little bit. But, so we mentioned Don Owen, and that was one of those candidacies where even Dave at the end of it kind of felt like, wow, like, you know, like, we, you know, maybe nobody expected him to get in, but he did it, you know, even though his, like you said, there's really not a lot we can point to other than he was around for a long time.
Well, I mean, the Don Owen voters were a passionate bunch that really campaigned for him, too.
Yeah, that's true. And like I said, he had a lot of big fans, like you said, among the wrestlers as well. To me, one of the all-time screw-ups of the Wrestling Observer voters, like, if I were Dave, I would have tried to, like, retcon this because I think it's so absurd that it would happen. Is Kidani falling off the ballot? Like,
I agree. Yeah.
He'll
be back on.
Yeah. Because I think an argument. And this is what kind of where I was going to head with this. So Owen, we think, is probably not the greatest candidate. Some people love him, but I think a lot of people kind of don't think that he's that great. So, and you kind of compared Takagi to him. Does that influence your vote any in general? Just like, oh, X made the Hall of Fame, and Y is a better candidate to him, therefore he has to be in the Hall of Fame.
It's tough because you could say, like, well, maybe that person shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, but I don't think you can ignore it at the same time either. But I think
it sets precedent in a lot of ways.
It sets precedent in a lot of ways, and you have to sort of have to make these comparisons. I mean, maybe it's not overwhelming. You think Owen shouldn't be in and that Takagi hasn't done enough. That's fine, too.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility as well. Both of those things can be true as well. But even, like, the Japan region, like, Nakamura is in the Hall of Fame. And it's right. Because if you compare all of these other guys, then the bar is like feels like it's a lot lower when you compare it to that view, than the traditional view of Hall of Fame. And someone like Kidani falling off, again, it's like, this kind of is the reverse effect of that, because how can we vote for one of these other promoters when clearly Kidani is much more influential?
Well, you know an interesting argument against Kidani I saw recently? This was not like someone that would never vote him, but they made the point that, like, Kidani sort of, like, was forced to take a hands-off approach very early into his ownership and only has recently now sort of reasserted control by burying everyone on the roster, but...
Well, and he was correct to do so, in fact, so clearly he has something in mind, but I just think, I mean, we're going to talk about somebody else that this we have has a very similar case. It's like, if Takagi, like you said, I don't want to minimize his accomplishments, because what you said is very true, that they started off, much like we said about Tokyo Joshi, they started off really, really small and have become bigger, you know, to the point where they are a realistic, you know, top five promotion in Japan at this point. But if he's not around, if there's no Takagi in the wrestling world, I don't think that it's like the business is way mind-bogglingly different. Obviously, there's like changes without it. And, like, different wrestlers may go to different places or may never have even made it, you know. But I think if Kidani doesn't take over, and like, when they do and Bushiroad doesn't buy New Japan, then we're not talking about any of these people. like, you know, pretty much because New Japan wouldn't have been able to blow up the way they did. Like, there's no way it was going to happen how things were going.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and like, so, like, that influences everything to me. So I thought the Kidani falling off was, like, mind-bogglingly stupid, to be honest. I think a big problem with that is I think a lot of people give Gedo credit for stuff that's actually Kidani's doing. Like in the narrative is Gedo jumped in and saved the company and his booking made everything better, when in reality, Bushiroad buying the company is what did all of that much more so than his booking, because he was around before and they were on the verge of going out of business before Bushiroad came in. I always point to 2011. You could see Bushiroad posters at 01 shows. They were trying to wiggle in and buy 01 before they tried to buy New Japan. That's a fact I don't think a lot of people know on there. And that could have changed. Imagine how history would be different if Bushiroad had invested in 01.
Are you saying that there's a chance that Takuya Sugawara would be main eventing the Tokyo Dome?
I don't know about Sugawara specifically. I don't think he's the Okada of 01. I like Daichi would have been, I think, Okada in that version of history. Yes. And we would have seen. I think that they would have blown up. Like they would
Let me ask you this, and this ties into Rossi. Do you think? Well, I mean, I've heard stories like Bushiroad is encouraging the pushing of certain wrestlers and sort of others to be sort of. But do you think though that like Rossi's booking is so radically different, and that it's really just the promotional machine of like. You know, like, there's, like, that Stardom, like, pop-up in Tower Records and stuff like that going on in Japan right now, right? I mean, that's a huge factor. And so I do sort of maybe give Gedo quite a bit of credit, but that promotional machine is very...
Yeah, that's proof right there. Stardom, I mean, they were around for years, like, at a certain level, and they're at a way bigger level now, like, because, like, of Bushiroad's influence.
But that's the money to be able to spend on promotion as opposed to the booking, is, I guess, my point.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I that's the same thing for New Japan as well. It's like, you're not seeing, you know, remember when Okada did those promotional videos, like Mila Djokovic or whatever, on there? It's like, you're not getting these kind of deals. You're not getting a Tiger Mask W show with New Japan influence without Bushiroad's push for it.
Right.
You know, like Gato's booking is what it is. There's goods and bads we can all point to. But regardless of that, it wouldn't have happened how it did without his promotional influence. And the Stardom, that's more proof of Kidani's influence and Bushiroad as a whole, is that Stardom is now moving way up from where they were, even in the pandemic. They are bigger than where they were. And, I mean, like, we'll talk about Rossi. You know, Takagi overall, just to kind of spin it back to him, you know, because I think that's interesting, because you can point to Owen, and I think that's a good kind of mark in his favor, but then Kidani being off the ballot, that's kind of hard for me to separate, you know, overall when it comes to Takagi, more so than anything he specifically did. But you made some good points in your article, and he has things to his name, and what he did was very unique in the history of wrestling. Is it Hall of Fame worthy? That could be another thing. I think a thing that hurts him as well is that he's had chances in other companies and not really made any difference whatsoever.
Well, are you really going to hold Wrestle 1 for Takagi?
Yes. No, I'm just kidding. But even with Noah, he's had a hand in that, and Noah has not been able to grow up, you know, to any discernible region recently. And, you know, they've had a lot of opportunities, and they have a lot of money behind them as well. Like, CyberFight is a way bigger company than Bushiroad, in fact. And yet still... they're at where they're at. I don't think we've seen that kind of growth overall with them. So,
how shall I put this? I think Noah is technically tilted in an upward direction. I think there's no way that they would have done as many like larger than Korakin
advances
that they've done without that promotional machine.
I mean, I agree with that.
They did do that good Sumo Hall. Was it 2019 with the Kaito versus Kenno in the main event? Battle of Aesthetics.
The Battle of Aesthetics, yeah, a wonderful show.
That was a real that's a feather in the cap to like, get Noah, I guess, right? But like, there's no way that some of those larger than like 3,000 people, as much as they manage to get that, is possible.
And they're not running like, I mean, and the thing is, these kind of shows kind of tanked, but they're not running those junior shows at Sumo Hall either without a lot of this, you know. But that still didn't draw very well. A lot of the stuff they've done, actually, all of their shows this year have pretty much drawn poorly. Outside of the finals of the N1 and obviously Cyber Fight Fest, which is a big deal.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, I don't want to get like put.
No. Not that that's all on Takagi either.
Like, point to certain villains in that.
Yeah. It's not like I'm trying to blame Takagi. I'm just saying that it's not like he was a big difference maker, like with these chances that he's gotten outside of DDT. So I do think that actually kind of works against him.
I'm going to be honest with you, Dylan. What I'm going to be watching for is what happens to Noah once Muda retires.
That's going to be interesting. You know,
and I think that will tell us a lot.
Yeah. You're right about that. You're right about that. So that's interesting. Takagi, he pushed for him, and you know, that's definitely somebody that we're going to take a look at because he does represent the Japanese scene. And I like that we're getting these Japanese non-wrestlers a lot too, because for a long time it was all the American side. Now we are getting a lot more guys with that, pretty much. So we'll kind of go as the ballot listed again. I wanted to put your favorite first, or pretty much to give him the thing. we will go down the ballot. We will circle around to Rossi a little bit later, because I know we're just spoiling to talk about Rossi Ogawa there. Case's only point on this was like to hate on Rossi. So clearly Ogawa has people that don't like him.
I'll be a little more positive towards Rossi. I'm not going to guarantee biggest praise ever, but I'll have some nice things to say.
Do you have nice things to say about Lord James Beliers? With Japanese stuff here.
The former chairman of the Pacific Wrestling Federation.
The prestigious, non-existent deal.
So, I mean, he was a wrestler, but that obviously is not why he's on there, so you can't really look at that. And
I was looking at his career, by the way, and he actually was kind of underrated, like his career as a wrestler. He did a lot of stuff. in wrestling that I think nobody ever brings up because he's much more known for his All Japan stuff.
Yeah. Right. And so he obviously was in that circle that was one of the early guys to Japan in the 1950s, right? And so basically, his case is basically two things. He was a foreign scout for All Japan, although I thought the Funks also did that.
I like to say liaison because it sounds fancy.
Yeah. So, I mean, see, like, that's always something that I thought the Funks did. But, I mean, you can have more than, like, you know, a couple of people doing that, obviously. Like, what I, like, it's claimed that, like, he sort of brought in, like, Don Leo Jonathan to All Japan, which is, you know, a sizable name, and that he played a role in sort of getting the British Bulldogs to jump. And then the other element of his basically his case is that he was like a promoter in Hawaii, right? Although Hawaii has been one of those promotions. It's very hot and cold. It's had a few promotions go out of business, but it's also had some great success. And just looking at it, it's like, you know, he had some success, but I just don't think he was a Hall of Fame successful level promoter.
Yeah, what you said, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. Especially back in those days, the territories. I mean, we just talked about Don Owen in Portland. I love how he's already in the Hall of Fame, but we've talked about him so much on the show. Like, we cannot influence his case either way. He's already voted in. But regardless, you know, something like that, we'll talk about one of the guys in Memphis later on, too. There's actually a few promoters on the ballot that are interesting. Yeah, he was the Hawaii guy. He did a little bit of, like, commentary stuff with AWA later on. Like in the 80s and stuff. And I think most people know him even more than all of that stuff is just the guy, you know, like you said, the commissioner of the PWF reading the things before all the Triple Crown matches on there. That's kind of his main deal. To me, it's hard for me to vote for him when there's another guy that does a very similar thing and to me did something much more influential that we're literally about to talk about next. But he's cool. Like, you know, it's, I respect him. He definitely did a lot. Like I said, him as a wrestler is kind of underrated. But to me, for him, you know, being the master of ceremonies for the Triple Crown, being the booker in Hawaii and the promoter, I don't think that's a Hall of Fame career. It's a very respectable, a great run. But to me, I wouldn't put him in over some of these other guys.
Yeah, no, it's just the whole, like, there's no, like, I mean, if he was drawing, like, a massive success in Hawaii, but just not Hall-level success.
Yeah, it wasn't, like, anything that really changed the game. You know, like, you know, again, another thing, like, if he wasn't around, somebody inevitably would have come along and did a lot of the stuff that he did, you know, at the end of the day. And I'll compare him to the next one we have here, Bobby Bruns, who is not a dissimilar role to Bleers in Japan, but just a little bit of before him. And with JWA and getting Ricky Dozan into things. And to me, like, Bruns, that makes him a slam dunk candidate, to be honest with you. Without his influence on Ricky Dozan, Bleer's role would be non-existent in the first place. Again, similar to what we said about Kidani. You know, Bleers is better at everything else, and perhaps that makes up ground. But just this one thing, like, it's so special and strong that it's, like, a very unique case. Because normally I like a well-rounded career. I like somebody who has a little bit of everything. But with me, Bruns influencing Japan that much and getting Ricky Dozan into wrestling, like, that's, like, a game-changing move at a huge level. To me, that would put him as a Hall of Fame caliber person to me, over Bleers.
Absolutely. I'm voting for Bobby Bruns. And it's just, like, yeah, pure historical significance, but he brought he helped to bring wrestling to Japan and trained Ricky Dozan. So, I mean, he's got to go in, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for him, basically. You know, we wouldn't be talking about this.
Yeah, me either. Like, so, yeah, like, that's the thing. It's like, when that thing you do is so dramatic and influential, I think it's hard to argue against somebody like that. But I'm sure that there will be people that, like, he didn't do enough else. But to me, it's like that thing is so big that you have to look at it. But, yeah, I would pick of the two. Like I said, they're very similar candidates. But to me, Bruns is just way more influential than Bleers. So we do agree on that. Now there's somebody who I don't think I can talk about very, very unbiasedly. Dave Brown here, the commentator in Memphis for multiple promotions. And even he did show up in AEW that one time. They did that Memphis tribute deal. So he's still around even long after his retirement and everything like that. Also, I can confirm with 100% certainty, he was also the weatherman of my childhood on the station Action News 5. He was the weatherman on there. So I feel like I can't really be unbiased for him. But I'd like to see what your perspective is on Brown.
Okay, so a couple of things. Bouncing off of you can't be unbiased about him. This is something that I've noticed about commentators in general. If you were a kid growing up, like that's basically the case for anyone that's voting for a commentator. They were the commentator that was on the first wrestling or most of the wrestling they watched when they were a kid or a teenager, right?
Now, to be fair, I will say this. I knew him as the weatherman for much more than the wrestling, because I remember as a kid, Memphis was like the dying breed. They still had like a very small show on, but by that point I had much more focused on WCW. Like, to me, that as a kid, this is how I thought. Okay, the local wrestling was like minor leagues, and WCW and WWF were like the major leagues.
Well, I mean, that was minor league Memphis by that point for sure.
Yeah, even obviously that as well. But yeah, like my mom would always talk about him and Lance Russell, like, oh, you know, they were legendary and all of this stuff. But that was a little bit before my time. I really didn't appreciate him and Lance more until I went back later on as an adult and watched some of that other, like, old school Memphis stuff.
So, interestingly enough, I haven't watched a lot of Memphis. I've watched some and everything like that because, first of all, I wanted to see how good these punches that they used to throw in Memphis were that everyone used to rave about. And it's very true. Memphis may have been the territory with the best punches. But also what's sort of funny is that I had heard Lance Russell's name for years about, like, great commentators, but never really heard Dave Brown's name mentioned as much. So I always thought that was interesting. I just say that as someone with not a lot of familiarity in that sort of thing. And, like, I'm not sure, like I was getting on to my point, I'm not sure how many people weren't watching Dave Brown or any commentator in real time would vote for a commentator, right? Because, like,
yeah.
If you were a commentator for a hot territory, well, because there's other ones on here, like, okay, but, like, that a Hall of Fame just because you were a commentator for that thing? So I don't know. I mean, I'm guilty of, we'll get into someone else that I'm voting that I'm guilty of being growing up on too, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not voting for Dave Brown, but I think, you know, I think there's absolutely a case there. I mean, Lance, you know, alongside Lance Russell, but I just find it also curious that I always heard Lance Russell's name far more than Dave.
That's true. Russell is the one that is more legendary than Dave. Dave was more of the sidekick, more or less. To briefly explain their style, they were very, like, realistic. Lance was a great hype man from Memphis in that, not like the JR, you know, going crazy style of hype man. It was like, he would be very cool and collected, and if there was a main event, like, he'd be like a 2 on everything excitement-wise, and then he'd jump it up to a 4 on something that was like, or like a 4 or 5 on something that was big. And it would make it, even though it wasn't like going crazy yelling or anything like that, he knew how to make things seem bigger just with a little bit of change in his voice. Lance did. Dave, he was just a very good commentator, you know, honestly. Like, they to me are the best team that I could say, and maybe I am biased being from Memphis, but I think he should be in, personally. Just like you said, it's going to be interesting. Because there's a lot of guys on this ballot for the non-wrestlers where it's like, well, are you really going to vote for this kind of guy? Like, you know, like on there. I think there's multiple guys you can point to, but the commentating team is very important to me. Like, you know, like if Mauro Ranallo is on a show, that's going to drop it, like, exponentially to me. Like, it makes me hate.
Let me ask you this. Were you always a Mauro hater, or did he just eventually get on your nerves too much?
I liked him, like, when he did those shows, they put those matches online when they were doing, like, Noah, like the 2004-05 Noah. I thought he was pretty good there, but pretty much his entire career in wrestling, and even in boxing, he actually did commentary for, like, Showtime Boxing as well. Yeah. He was I don't know. I'm not a big fan of his. Let's just say that. And if he's on a show, or like even so, let's say Matt Stryker, another guy who I hate. Like if he's on a show, that makes it worse automatically. Whereas somebody good will make it better, you know, at the end of the day. And there's not a lot of good ones these days, to be honest with you. But like, look at the difference in AEW when Taz is in there compared to JR. I think that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. Well, yeah. JR's getting worse because he's been sort of banished to Rampage. And he was incredibly annoying last night, I thought.
Yeah, I don't watch Rampage, so that's a good thing. That's another reason for me not to watch that. You know, but that's actually kind of amusing to me that they actually just like, because it's like they took him forever. It's like everyone knew he sucked from the beginning, but they just kept throwing him out there anyway. And it's clear that he actually hates this show as well, which is kind of funny to me. Like that's actually kind of amusing. And even on his podcast, sometimes he'll be like calling stuff. And then he'll go on the show and be like, well, that just sucked. And like on the show, he was acting excited. To me, I think that's like a really terrible thing because it's like it totally proves that any enthusiasm that you had is like totally fake. And even by the wrestling standards, that's very bad in my opinion. But yeah, the point is, I think commentators can definitely, more than any of these other types of people we're going to talk about, I think commentators can change the show for the better. And I think he was great in his role, in my opinion, Dave was. But I know that, like I said, we're getting into these old school guys. Same thing with the next guy, Bob Caudle. Look, he's similar to Brown, even down to also being a weatherman in North Carolina. I don't know why the weathermen commentated wrestling so much in the territory days, but it just is how it was. He was good, but to me, Brown was the better commentator and a part of the more a well-rounded team overall to Caudle. But like, so like they're very similar. Just like you said, if you grew up in North Carolina territory,
exactly,
then you probably have an affinity for him more than me.
Yeah, that's what I would say about it too. And he's got considerable longevity. He was started in, like the 70s, I think, and then lasted all the way to like 1991 at WCW, and then commentated for Smoky Mountain.
Yeah, JR actually joined him for like a little bit when he was with WWF. They put him in Smoky Mountain with Caudle. Yeah, I mean, he was good. I've heard some of his shows. I'm not, like, super – I feel like I've heard a million shows of his. But he was pretty good as more – but he was, like, a very dry commentator. To me, like, Lance and Dave were much more entertaining as a duo than Cottle and maybe even somebody, you know – just to me, I think he was more dry than Brown. That's just my opinion.
I haven't watched a lot in his heyday, I should say, because a lot of the sort of, I guess, Crockett stuff that I've watched is a little later where he's on less, and it's like David and Crockett and Tony Schiavone. So, but, you know, a lot of people do swear by him and everything, so it's really going to come down to is, like, were you 10 years old watching Mid-Atlantic?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I'm just a little too young, I think, to really appreciate some. And that's true for some of these candidates, and I can admit that at the end of the day. And even then, he did a lot of stuff that was not even national, like, for years and years. Like you said, he started way before his later era there. So he's an interesting name. I think it's going to be tough for these regional commentators to get in overall, even though, I would love if Dave got in. Any of the Memphis guys getting in is, like, a pro to me. But, you know, just overall, I think realistically these guys are going to have a tough go of it. So then we move from the commentators to Bobby Davis, one of the OG managers ever in wrestling. What do you think about Davis here?
So I had not been familiar with Davis until, was it last year or the year before? Like, Dave put him on the ballot, and, like, there are a lot of very, like, pro-Bobby Davis people. Basically, he invented the modern manager in North America. So I think your feelings about managers may affect whether or not you're going to vote for him, right? Like,
and it's kind of tough, similar to, like, we were talking about with me, Case, where he was saying, oh, shoot, Styles dead. The manager in America is not nearly where it was.
No.
You know, that I think if this category was around 30, 40, you know, years ago, I think that we would have a different perspective than we have now, where it's not just died out. It's been died out for decades at this point.
Yeah, but it was a thing, and it still is technically a thing, right? Like, even on the indies, there's still managers, and obviously AEW has brought it back to a certain extent, right? Like, you know, I mean, a lot of people were really happy to see, like, Prince Nana getting a spot and everything.
Prince Nana, very good. Yeah, yes, I agree with this.
So, you know, I'm not voting for him, but I understand if you think managers are, like, an incredible part of wrestling, why you would. Now, Dylan, were you aware of this fact about Bobby Davis? Did you know that he's from the same hometown as Wendy's founder Dave Thomas?
Now, this is the kind of research you won't get on the other shows, my friends, right now. Big Dave. So this, to me, makes him an easy slam dunk candidate. As we know,
I was going to say, yeah, I think this might affect your feelings.
Yes, as longtime listeners will know, my favorite food is the spicy chicken sandwich from Wendy's. So if he somehow played some kind of role in Dave Thomas inventing Wendy's, which in my head canon he now does, I think that obviously makes him a strong Hall of Famer.
So he was an early investor in Wendy's and operated a bunch of franchises, and that obviously, like, made him wealthy, and so that's part got out of wrestling.
He's a genius. So it's time to Hall of Fame up Bobby Davis, is what I'm hearing with these words. But honestly, like, when I was doing research on him, he is a Hall of Famer in my book. Like, he was one of the first ever at his position, you know, at the end of the day, and I think that means something. And we kind of talked about this with the shoot style stuff again. Yes, it's dead now, but it had its time. You know, like, it was influential for a time. It just, times changed eventually. But that to me, in my opinion, doesn't take away the influence. I said the same thing about Fujiwara. I, like, to me, just because something dies out eventually, if you have decades of influence, that still counts for something to me. And he definitely counts. He was the original manager of Champions, a guy – you know, most notably managing Nature Boy Buddy Rogers and many others as well. Influenced Bobby Heenan as well. You know, one of the most popular ones of all time. Yep. The thing with him that's going to hurt him is, how can we quantify his actual performance when he's so old that I have we have nothing to go by in terms of what was he a good manager or not? How can we know when we never saw him? You know, because, like, that's not possible in this day.
Right. We just have, like, well, I mean, he was obviously managers for these big names.
And yeah, we...
prototype, basically. Because he was taking bumps and everything.
Yeah, we have, like, we have the stories and the tales and the accomplishments, but we don't have it on video, and I think that's going to hurt him.
Yeah.
But to me, his accolades, like, to me, he seems like a Hall of Fame guy. Just my opinion. But yeah, I think that's good. And now that you've dropped the Wendy's gimmick, he's definitely in the top five in my book now. Like, he was already like a guy that I thought was one of the better candidates, but the Wendy's stuff puts him as a top candidate for sure. Joe Higuchi up next too. See, now we're getting into the different styles, and I think that's something that's kind of interesting in this category, somewhat similar to the Europe region where it's like, oh yeah, also Australia, and oh, here's a Puerto Rican candidate, Carlos Colon, and now South Africa, and it's like all of these different things that aren't necessarily the same to each other. Now in this non-wrestler, we're comparing a commentator to a promoter to a manager and now a referee. All of these things have different – how can you compare them per se? I think that's a tough call here, and I think that's something that I kind of wish was sorted out a little bit more, because to me, again, much like the commentators, referees can change the game. To me, like, again, like Red Shoes, to me – hurts his matches. Like, when he, to me, drags down all of his matches because he's an awful performer, in my opinion. Like, totally, you know, putting the spotlight on himself, which he should not do. Even people at AEW, there's a couple of referees that don't do a good job, in my opinion. And when they're in, it makes their matches worse. You know, but then there's somebody like Higuchi who's so well-respected for everybody. So what is your take on Higuchi specifically as a referee candidate here?
Well, I mean, he's got like 20,000 matches over 32 years, so you can say longevity. I never thought he was like the greatest referee, to be honest with you.
He didn't stand up as much as WADA.
I think WADA's the greatest referee ever, and it's probably, well, in part because of why he's not so great now is because he was just so goddamn nimble and just, like, added to the drama of those, like, big matches in the 90s.
Yeah, you know, I've read about him that he was super well respected by all the wrestlers. Like, they thought he was by far the best.
I'm sure he was, yeah.
He later also took up a very similar role to who we talked about earlier, Lord James Blears. And Noah Higuchi was kind of that guy, pretty much, for a long time. He had a lot of respect from the fans, and I will say this for him. He, as a referee, had shows built around him, specifically when he retired in All Japan in the 90s, and then after his passing, Noah did a show for him as well.
Yep.
I think that speaks to his, like, respect level and love of the local fans. But again, I think we're ultimately American and Canadian. So I think if we were Japanese, we would understand it more. If we were there, I think that there's a little bit of a barrier for us compared to the local Japanese fans.
How should I put this? Because it didn't feel like New Japan went to the same extent for Tiger Hattori.
Yeah. I agree with that. And he even did backstage stuff. Like, he was another liaison to the English speaker. Now, yeah, like you said, Higuchi got more of that than he did in New Japan.
Although, to be fair, Tiger Hattori, like, split from New Japan multiple times.
Hey, like, the New Japan was – did you not listen to my Inoki show? There was a lot going on over the years in New Japan. But, yeah, I think that's something to look at. That, to me, makes him an interesting case, but he doesn't pop off to me, you know. And I think that's more of, like, again, the gap of anything. But he seems like he could – like, if he got in – it's not like I'd be like, no. He seems like a yes to me. But I think that – and I also think that there's going to be some people, too, that will be like, well, referees don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Like, it should be performers and active performers, which referee is kind of but not directly. But I think they are important personally. So I don't agree with that part. I hope that that's not something that
– Yeah, I don't agree with that either.
Yeah, so I think if there is a referee, he's as good of a pick to go with as any. You could say that there are some better, but yeah.
Well, I'll make this statement. I'm not going to vote for a referee until WADA gets on the ballot.
This is, WADA Respect Army. You are the leader of right now here. But he's ruining his legacy. And that's the one thing Higuchi cannot say about him. But yeah, WADA, like – back then, if you had asked me who was the top referee, I would have said Wada over Higuchi, honestly. But we will see how it goes. Like I said, it says something to me that he did get those special shows and all this love, and he's super well-respected by everybody. Like, that to me counts for something. So I just don't think – like I said, I think if we were Japanese, I think we may have a different outlook on this than we do, because I think we're kind of on the same page.
He was probably also doing stuff behind the scenes all the way in the JWA, too.
Yeah, and I had heard something about him, too, is that he was, like, a really good wrestler. But he was not big enough, and he couldn't take the injuries. And that's what made him great as a referee, is he knew how to, like, he was more about putting the wrestlers over than getting spotlight on himself, was kind of like his rep, more or less. And, like, he knew how to position himself to where, like, a thing I read about him is that he knew where to stand to where he wouldn't get in the way of the photographers at ringside.
So Dylan, what you're saying is that Bryce Remsburg should study Joe Higuchi matches?
All of the AEW referees should study his matches, I would say. But that's not something fans would care about as much, I think, though. Like, or notice, I think, easily. That would be more important to wrestlers than maybe the fans. But Higuchi's a good candidate. We will see what happens with him. Like, he's a guy I could see swayed. If some of these other guys get in or drop off, I could see him being a guy. What about Jim Johnston? This is another one, I think, if you're a Japanese voter, I don't think his influence will be able to be said as much unless you were in the, you know, a fan during the Attitude Era. But what
he was there until 2017, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, that's true. He was around for a long time.
But I think his quality sort of dropped off.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
This will come down to like one's preference on like how they felt about those themes in the 90s, basically. Like he wrote Ultimate Warrior and Stone Cold, I think, are some of the ones that he's sort of just like famous for that are generally considered like very popular songs that sort of fit the feeling of wrestler.
Yeah.
You can make a case that he had significant business success because those WWE, the albums, sold quite well in the late 90s and early 2000s.
That's a great point. I didn't even note that, but yeah, you're totally right. Now you bring up that's an obvious thing that should be thought about more.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and I guess, you know, I mean, music really is so important to wrestling, even though it was the Japanese that did it first.
Yeah.
My understanding.
I think Gorgeous George had the original theme music, so but it wasn't that regular until later on.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think there's a pretty strong case for him, although I'm not going to be voting.
Gerard, let me ask you this. First of all, here's an Easter egg. I don't know if it's well known or not, but it's something I noticed. I think it was said to me by somebody else, and I noticed it. Listen to Razor Ramon's theme song and then Stone Cold's theme song back to back. It's like the exact same song. Like, if you listen to it a certain way, like the cadence of it is like super similar. Like,
I'm not surprised he's recycling stuff like that.
Yeah,
they straight up would recycle themes.
Yeah, like
not even change them.
Yeah, like Kona Crush's theme was like exactly the same as Sid Justice's, pretty much. And that was exactly the same.
I can't remember who it was because I was talking about this just a couple of months ago, but they gave Dan Severn's theme to someone else too.
Even Kurt Angle's theme was the Patriots theme.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's not on him. That's like.
Yeah. That's a good point. But I just remember crushing disappointment because I thought the Patriot was returning when that music hit the first time. And then it was Kurt Angle. And I was like, what? Because the Patriot was my guy like when I was a kid. But regardless of all that, what's your favorite WWE theme songs over the years?
Dan Severn's, actually. I love that theme.
Okay.
What else?
And then later on, he would have like real songs, pretty much, as theme songs, like you know, lyrics and stuff like that.
What else? I think the Ultimate Warrior's theme is great. Like just for setting the stage and everything.
Yeah, that's like a great wrestling theme more than like a great song. But it fits him perfectly, though. Like his whole gimmick. Like when that music hits, he comes flying out. That's like that was a huge part of his popularity as well. I think music cannot be understated how important it is. I've always said that interest music is really important to a wrestler.
I think Owen Hart's theme.
High energy.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. Not his later theme, which kind of sucked, like, to be honest. Hey, his Nation theme was great, though. But his singles theme, like, in between that was kind of crappy. But the high-energy theme was a great theme. Even Brett's theme was
Brett's theme's really good. I mean, Stone Cold's fits.
Shawn Michaels.
Yeah, whatever. I just thought it was bizarre that, like, he sang his own theme.
At first it was Sensational Sherry, then they changed it to him singing. definitely made it weirder.
I feel like I'm missing something obvious. I didn't really like Mankind's theme.
Which version? The dark, like emo version?
The later one, 99.
The car crash one. Yeah. All of these are kind of basic themes, but they just fit the character so much. Like, even the Rock's theme, it's not like it's this kind of amazing piece of music or anything, but it fit him so well.
No, it just has a big intro, and then it's just the Rock says.
Yeah, exactly. That's the same thing with Austin, like the glass shatters. That's an iconic thing more than... though the one with the lyrics that came later was a really, like, cool song as well. Like, when they added lyrics to it.
Now, did he write... Am I wrong about this, but did he sort of write some of those later Triple H themes, but it would just be Motorhead performing them?
That's the thing, because, like, they had, like, even Kane's theme was, like, a great song for him, but did he, like, what did he have to do with all of this? Because those were, like, real people, like doing these songs. So,
I'm pretty sure, though, he did play with the DX band, though. I do know that.
Oh, yeah, like, the original theme had that My Time theme he had, which was, I actually like that song better than the Motorhead one, personally. I don't know. Like, so there's a lot of themes, and like I said, we don't know exactly how much influence he had on these songs as well.
Well, I think most of them, yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
I mean, I think there's absolutely a case there for sure.
And I think you also have to look at how things have tailed off without him. Their themes now are like super generic. Yeah, like I said, they've kind of caught on with something with this Seth Rollins bullcrap, because the fans took it over. But again, like, if they hadn't have done that, like, his song's pretty basic, like, at the end of the day. I think they're actually doing better than they were for a little while there, like, when he first left. They have a few themes that are okay, and then you have, like, Damage Control's theme, which is, like, awful, like, pretty much, there. So we'll have to see. But yeah, Johnston.
I don't even think I've heard Damage Control's theme.
Oh, well.
Because I haven't really been watching anything.
Oh yeah, well, like I said, EO's in Damage Control, so her singles theme is way better than the Damage Control theme, in my opinion. And that's like a real song. There was like they come out to this rap theme, but it's bad, man. Like, it's a bad theme. I will DM it to you later. You can determine. and I think another thing too is like, if you put him in, would that also qualify to say a camera guy? Like, because the camera work's very important to the shows, too. Cause, like,
are you saying that Kevin Dunn should be in the Hall of Fame?
No, I'm saying he's a Hall of Shame member. but he proves that he can make shows worse with bad camera work there. And so, we it's like, how deep will this go? But I do think he's an interesting candidate, at least. Larry Matisic. And he's kind of a jack. He's like a guy who's a jack of all trades, pretty much. But what do you think of Matisic as a candidate?
Well, I mean, he is obviously someone that Dave holds in very, very high respect because they were friends, and Matisic basically, I think it was like, basically Matisic and Terry Funk told Dave everything about the business. So he was very close to, and like, my own, like, he's got a pretty impressive resume, but my only thing is like, I guess, how much was it him and how much was it Sam Mushnick in St. Louis? Because, you know, Matisic went out on his own when Mushnick retired and just had to basically give up and go to the WWF.
That's a good point. He did also
He was a co-booker with Pat O'Connor as well.
That's true.
So that sort of, muddies the water. But, I mean, obviously, like, St. Louis was one of the most important territories in the country, generally free from bullshit, presented it as a serious sport generally.
Yeah, he also went on to become like a writer as well, writing a bunch of books and a story.
That's true too, yeah.
Story and stuff as well. Although I will say Fredo told me one time he didn't like one of his books that he wrote. Sure. So the quality has to be judged or whatever. Like I said, he's done everything. Like, he was a commentator. He was one of the bookers. He was a writer. They did a lot of cool stuff at Wrestling at the Chase. You know, it's like I said, he's a very well-rounded candidate. I just don't know if he did any one thing at a Hall of Fame level.
Yes.
But he did all. Yeah, he did all this stuff combined. And maybe, like, is this, you know, is the total, you know, better than the parts? You know, is the sum better than the parts? You know, you have to wonder.
Absolutely.
I think he's a guy to look at, you know, but I don't feel strongly.
I would have to know more about, I guess, the nuts and bolts of St. Louis.
Yeah,
again, definitely stuff there, but it's just like, I don't know how much of it was him.
Yeah, and this is bygone eras that we can't really say for sure, you know, at the end of the day. That's going to make it tough. But like I said, he's a guy that if he got in, I wouldn't argue it, per se. No. And you know, like, you made a great point. You know Dave wants him in.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so.
But Dave didn't get him in automatically, so, I mean, so I'm assuming, yeah, like, even some of the older people aren't
that's
necessarily
a good point.
Voting for him.
Yeah, that's an interesting point right there too. Why wasn't
he
like
got in probably because of a lot of the old guys? So
right,
Madison hasn't yet. So
yeah, that's interesting. Like, that's a really interesting point actually. like I said, he doesn't pop for me the way some others do. But like I said, I wouldn't like think, oh, this is a horrible candidate to put in or anything if he did, but. James Melby up next. He's more specifically a writer this point. So what do you think of him?
So, I mean, he sort of innovated wrestling. I could also hate him for that. You know? That's a bit of a joke, but obviously, like, he's like a pioneer in that sort of thing. And he was, like, one of the first people to, like, write actual books about pro wrestling and everything like that. They named an award after him.
That Trego Synthes Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah. Basically, that they give to journalists, and I think they've given it to Donaldson, they've given it to some other people. I don't know. Like, I just, you know, it's sort of like, I, you know, he was before, like, most of his work was before my time.
That was a point that I was going to make. I feel like if we were 30 years older, we would have
I'd probably have a book on my shelf and would be.
And we would just be able to appreciate what he did more. But because we're where we're at, I think it's lost on us. Like, you know, so like, I mean, when I looked at this group, he was behind a lot of the candidates personally.
Yes. And, you know, I'm sure Dave wants him in because Dave, much like Vince McMahon, will never put himself in his own Hall of Fame.
That's an interesting debate. Like, would Meltzer be in his own Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, if by non-wrestler standards, I would vote for Dave in the Hall of Fame, honestly.
Yeah, I would too, I think. Like, he's super. I mean, he proved even last year with the Stardom, like Utami and Shuri, his rating, direct influence. Right away. Like, him rating that so high got tons of eyes that wouldn't have been on that match otherwise. And it's like his writing over the years, and he's been at it for so long. I agree with you. I think I would vote for him too, in his Hall of Fame. But like you said, I don't think he'll ever do that.
No, he won't. Yeah, because he's even said it, so.
Yeah. False humility. No, Meltzer's part. But now we get to a fun one, the one we've all been waiting for. Rossi Ogawa here. So I'm sure, like I said, we kind of brought him up already, so you have your thoughts on him. I'd like to hear what they are. I'd like to hear your takes on the Hat Man.
So I guess what I would say is not yet, but I could see myself voting for Rossi in the future, depending on what happens with Stardom. I mean, he has some significant pros. I mean, obviously the booking of the interpromotional stuff with All Japan Women and like AWP and like LLPW and FMW, that's huge. I think he deserves, from my understanding, of course, he deserves some plaudits for that. He's got some misfires like Arcian. And was it you that said that it was like Aja Kong, like behind the best stuff in Arcian? Somebody told me that. I can't remember.
Yeah, so his career is very interesting, ups and downs. You know, so here's the thing. He's done a lot too. He's kind of underrated in terms of his all around stuff because he's been around since the '70s. Yep. He started out as like a photographer, really was influential in the Crush Gals, getting a lot of rub, in All Japan.
Okay, which is an interesting question because like when I first heard of his connection to the Crush Gals, what I understood is that he was like driving them around to public. Is it like more hands on than that?
No, he was still like he was with them, but not like behind the scenes. Like it wasn't like he was making the call to like and you know doing anything noteworthy. But he was just around them and that
like if
kind
you
of
told me that he plotted their like whole like kind of tournament
no.
idols. Then
no.
Give them that.
No. Okay. So he got more influence later on in the '90s, which obviously had extreme highs. But here's a bad thing about him, like a really big black mark, in my opinion, against him. He was responsible for the idea. So basically, in the mid-90s, when things were hitting the fan because of the Matsunaga's bad investments costing them a ton of money and killing the company, Ogawa's big idea was he wanted to focus on the home video market rather than save All Japan Women's TV presence, which super backfired and hurt the company. Like, they needed that TV. They thought that they could, like, you know, Ogawa thought that he could beat the TV networks. But it didn't work. Like,
possibly a dumber idea to do in Japan than in America.
Yeah, it failed miserably. And, I mean, here's the thing, though. It is bad, and it was a huge mistake. But also the debt that the Matsunagas were building up probably would have sunk the company anyway, and they still last for a long time. But it was a big blunder, and he ended up leaving around the late 90s. And that's when he went to Arceon, which, I mean, it was great for like a short period.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the first Joshi I ever watched.
Yeah, it was great.
I have a soft spot for it.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with you. There's a really good stuff there. The influence that he died because Yoshida was there and she brought a lot of the lucha influence and stuff to Arceon with her great style, like amazing wrestler. Aja jumped to there eventually. Arceon was great for a short period, but it got mismanaged and pretty quickly the wheels started to come off. It led to a major falling out with him and Aja Kong. Like, you know, it's like, I can't say for sure who had the good ideas more than him and Aja, but I do know things hit the fan, like, between them. And even the Japanese wiki was like, there was a lawsuit between them.
Yep, I read that, yeah.
Yeah, by the end there. And it all started where they had this girl that they really wanted to push, or Rossi, like, it was his big idea that he wanted to push, Ryu Miyuki, I think was her name, and she sucked. Like she was like an idol, the ultimate idol wrestler. Okay, so like Ryu Miyuki, and Rossi really wanted to push her big, but Aja was like, no, like at the end of it, and that caused a major falling out. And then they both ended up leaving. Even Miyuki ended up leaving. She was actually in the early days of DDT as well after Arceon, believe it or not, because she was like better as a comedy wrestler than a real wrestler. But the point is, things really hit the fan in Arceon. Then he went to JD Star, which was a kind of a flop as well, ultimately. Although, like, JD Star, that was kind of like, that turned into Rossi's baby, and it didn't really work, but it was somewhat influential because they kind of, through JD Star, was a springboard to Stardom, which became hugely successful. And even now, like, the Actress Girls, their existence is on a similar principle to what he had in mind with this Athres concept. JD Star, which, again, it didn't work at all, but they're still kind of trying that with Actress. Like, you know, obviously the actress and the wrestler, the other one's an athlete and wrestler. It's kind of the same, right? And then Stardom, it's brought back Joshi through his influence, but what we talked about earlier, it was more so Bushiroad buying them than necessarily him, which, I mean, he deserves credit for in his own right to last long enough and be successful in its own right to be on the radar to get there, and he definitely deserves credit for it. But, yeah, you know, like you said, he's somebody that I think I would like to wait and see a few years to see just how far they go. But with a 45 career year, there's a lot there, but there's also a lot of it that's actually not good.
And well, he was sitting out at times too, like between JD Star and Stardom. Now, I want to ask you this, and I don't necessarily agree with all of this, but I've seen some people try to make this something like that it's a hit against Rossi because he's basically relying too much on these women's sex appeal to try to sell tickets. What do you think of that?
I mean, no, I don't agree with that.
I don't agree with it either, but I've seen it pop up a couple of times recently. So
that's kind of a talking point.
I wanted to bring it up, but it's pro wrestling. And also, I mean, they're also selling the men that way too. In Japan, especially.
Yeah, like I think that's kind of my point against all of that is that the men's marketing is the same way, like pretty much. I think if anything, maybe in like the 2000s where things were like the dark ages, you would see a lot more like somebody like an Io Shirai and an Asuka, like in WWE Kana. They did like the gravure stuff, right?
Oh, well, I mean, there was even, when was Takako Inoue doing that? Like that was still during the peak of All Japan Women, wasn't
it? Well, yes, Takako was definitely an idol wrestler and a great performer, but like, you know, she had obvious sex appeal as well, you know.
But I mean, at the same time, like, you know, the when, you know, you're only selling like 900 tickets to Orkin, you got to pay the bills other ways.
Yeah, like I mean, and I think that too. Like, I mean, but even then, it wasn't even just like, oh, Zinjo was the only one doing it. I mean, like, you know, JWP had photo books and crap too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like very, very influential or not influential.
Well, and now, like, there's the Roppongi 3K photo book. There's the Access, like Shiozaki and Akajima. They all have photo books too.
Yeah, they're appealing to the women fans as well, but primarily in Japan with that.
I think people sort of look at the trajectory that Joshi's gone from, because I've actually been watching a bunch of 1985 Zenjo.
Good idea.
And like it goes from like the screaming teenage girls into even by like 92, it's like all guys in the audience.
Yeah, check out on, I know you're a subscriber. But if anybody's listening, you got to check out the Patreon starting in November, because I wrote a ton of write-ups on matches of Manami Toyota's career, and we talk about a little bit with her and Yamada as well a little bit later, but a ton of matches throughout her career, and you can actually see that exact thing where the first match I did was from 1989, and in there it was all teenage girls, like the entire crowd. And then through the next 3 years, they shifted towards more of the male fans as went in. But even then, that wasn't necessarily like through sex appeal. It was more so they booked more on, like they actually specifically booked more on work rate, like with your Toyotas and Hokutos and stuff.
And also that was sort of in part shooting them because of the retirement age, shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah.
So you lost like the best idols.
And that was the Matsunaga's fault because they, in their mind, remember at this time, JWP had collapsed the first time, like this happened multiple times when JWP collapsed, but the first time, and they basically were like, the, like, Naga Yo and all these people, they wanted to stay, and that's why they came back eventually, but they, in their mind, they were like, well, there's really no competition for us, so, it, like, we could just make new stars. So it totally bit them in the ass in the long run. But, yeah, like, the retirement age stuff really hurt them, for sure.
But, yeah, so that was just a sort of something I saw in Rossi, but it doesn't. And I'm sure it will rear its head again, but it's not.
That feels like a talking point for people that are, like, anti-Rossi. But not necessarily, like, that. I don't think people in Japan think that way at all.
Yeah.
To be honest, but... you know,
I mean, like, in an ideal world, my preferred, like, style of Joshi would be, like, Sendai Girls being the biggest company or something.
I think Stardom, I mean,
I think Stardom has definitely evolved, absolutely.
I mean, if anything, like, the early days were much more like that with, like, Yuzupon being the top star, like, who was an idol wrestler. And it was a good performer, but still, her popularity was based on idol stuff. Like Tokyo Joshi Pro is more, way more of an idol company.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. Oh, yeah. And there's just Rossi booking rhythms that I'm not crazy about.
Oh yeah, he's
him,
not
perfect. Him holding title matches in the middle of a tournament just bothers me so much.
That was goofy.
He's done this. He's done that a lot too, has he not?
You know, it's very weird when that happens. You know, and like now they're heading into more of this like old school Stardom Army deal that they're trying to do, and it looks kind of bad, to be honest, like what they're doing. And I'm a big fan of Nanae Takahashi. Don't get me wrong. I love her to death. Like, great wrestler. One of the best in Joshi or whatever. But what they're doing is not the best overall, I would say, right now. And like you said, yeah, the tournament title match was really goofy. And the one they had, it doesn't make a lot of sense overall.
Well, I have one more reason why I let it, like, you know, as they say, it's a bit of a cliche, but let it play out. Because,
yeah,
I mean, like, we will know. I think we'll know sooner, like in 2-3 years, we'll finally get to that Hall of Fame level.
I think the fact that New Japan has a women's title shows you that Stardom's influence is really big.
Oh, yeah.
Like because they wouldn't want to do that, and we've already heard rumors that a lot of people aren't happy about it in New Japan. Sure. And did I not say that when they introduced the belt? I told y'all that was going to happen, and nobody wanted to believe me. But there it was. Like, we're already seeing it before the belt even gets introduced. We're already seeing it, and I think that Stardom's. So here's the thing. You can call out certain things with him, but the red belt is handled so well, and like the titles and the main stars, because Julia, to me, I think is going to be like what Okada was for New Japan when she wins that title.
Very likely.
Yeah, like she is going to be the top star. Like, this is what they've been waiting for. Although I love Shuri Kondo, and like she's an amazing wrestler, but like last year's story was amazing. The one they did with her winning the title at the end of the year. This with Julia, once she gets the title, I really think that she is going to be like the face of Stardom and elevate things to a next level. She's like a top 1% in terms of like how she carries herself, her star power. I think Stardom's got a very bright future in the future, and we're going to see that things go up. And when these restrictions go down, that's really going to be interesting. Like what happens next? Because
they're going to be clarifying for a lot of people. I think there's some. I think that will tell us some more. Like, I obviously think Takagi should be in, but I think, you know, that will tell us whether or not that candidacy has any eggs.
Yeah, and I think Ogawa will only get helped from it. I really think they're on a good run right now. The future is good, but the thing is, things can change so fast in wrestling that this could all get screwed up for one reason or another. You know, Julia could sign with WWE.
I think she could command 7 figures from an American company, I think.
And if that happens, we need to start about putting her in the Hall of Fame. I think. But I mean, like I said, if that just happened, where one day somebody was just like, well, I don't think AEW would do it because their women division isn't that prominent. But like, if Triple H one day was just like, we need a top star, like we need a new star, and then somebody handed him Julia, I think that could be something that would be in play. But like, they've done a great job where, similar to New Japan, where it feels like now with Bushiroad, they're not as vulnerable to that. Like, they can keep their top stars now.
Right.
And I think that's very realistic. But I'm just saying, we don't know. Like, again, we're talking about stuff in the future that nobody knows, you know, at the end of the day. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But right now, I probably wouldn't vote for Ogawa, but he does have a case, I would say.
Yeah.
Reggie Parks, the belt maker, known for 50 years almost of making titles in wrestling. What's your take on Parks?
I'm not going to vote for him, and I guess it really comes down to, like, how big of a mark for the belt you are, you know? This sounds mean, maybe, but, like, it's true, I think. You know, like, obviously, titles are very important in wrestling, and he's, like, the belts he's designed are beautiful. He's designed the famous winged old WWF belt. He designed the original and much superior GHC heavyweight title.
I totally agree on that point.
Yeah. So I think he designed those. Do you remember like the 90s WWF tag title belts?
Yep.
Those are really nice too, you know? So yeah, I mean,
he even designed like indie stuff. Like he did to the 2000s. He was working with these companies like Ring of Honors, your Shimmers and all this stuff. He made those belts.
Yeah. Am I against him going in? No, I just don't. I'm not going to vote for him unless there's like only like 3 candidates left in here.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. Like, he doesn't pop for me. Like, you know, I mean, like, he's a legend, and it's like he's the number one guy in history at his position.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, It's like, how much did this you know, because like we've seen good belts and we've seen crappy belt designs, but did it really change anything?
Oh, I think he designed the last IWGP Heavyweight title too. Did that was a great belt.
Yeah, like all of his, like all of the stuff you can point to are really good. Yeah. I just, I mean, like there's been a bunch of IWGP title belts, and it's not like. It really made that big of a difference to me, whether it
Well, you know, we were talking about the IWGP Women's title, and I got to say, I like that belt because that...
Oh, yeah, I really like that.
That crown is my favorite IWGP title, I think.
Oh, totally agree. Like, that's my favorite IWGP, too, is the crown design, which they kind of tried to reference with this new version, the IWGP World title. This one directly references it, this Women's title. And it has the stars on the side, too, so it kind of has both companies involved. I really like the women's title at IWGP. I don't know who made that, but a shout-out to whoever did. But, yeah, I'm totally with you on Parks. Like, great at his position, but he just doesn't pop or feel that influential to me, ultimately.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in wrestling that love their fucking belts.
That's a good point. Now, isn't that going to be interesting? Because I bet a lot of these guys probably have votes in this, to these belt marks.
I don't know how many of the belt marks have votes, but there's definitely a constituency.
It's going to be interesting to see here.
Like, is Matt Cardona voting for Reggie Parks? I'm sure he is.
Yeah. Why is Matt Cardona catching strays on this show right now?
Oh, really? I'm off the top of my head being like, well, who would be into belts?
Yeah, okay, you're totally right. Let's be real. You are completely right. I'm not arguing with you at all. I'm just saying. On there. But yeah, more Sigel coming up here. This guy, Sigel, he was like a guy in Texas. He was like the main booker for a long time, like 37 years or something. Okay. What's your take on him?
Yeah, I'm voting for Morris Sigel. It's actually kind of hard to get good info on him because a lot of it, when you Google his name, it's like actually stuff about Paul Bosch. But like he was in Houston for 38 years. Houston was one of the top territories, even though it was really only Houston. It wasn't like, you know, half of Texas or anything like that. Because Texas was split up into Houston, Dallas, and Amarillo. And I think sort of what became Mid-South also had parts of northern Texas.
I think also we got a lot of international listeners and stuff like that. If you're not really American or familiar with America's geography, Texas is like a country. It's like the size of a country in and of itself to where you could drive for 7 hours and still be in Texas, like from one end of the other. So it's like Houston is on a totally different part than, you know, somewhere else pretty much in there. Like El Paso.
Yeah, I guess because Houston's like this. I'm not perfect on my Texas geography, but Houston's sort of like the east or southeast, right?
Yeah.
Because it's on the coast for the oil and everything.
Yeah.
Dallas is sort of like center north.
Yeah.
And then like
you're Amarillo better at your geography than you gave yourself.
And then Amarillo credit. Would be west Texas, right?
Right. Yeah, all of that is true. Like what you just said. Yeah. But yeah, go on.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So just like 38 years, one of the most important territories in the country. And like you can say, like, you know, he sort of cultivated Paul Bosch, who's a Hall of Fame and everything like that. And, like, I've talked to some people that are very, like, you know, Morris Sigel is obviously very important. It was one of the original guys involved in the NWA forming it. So, yeah, I think he.
Yeah, you know, I was reading about him a little bit, and he was a guy that there was a lot of stuff going on there. He was instrumental, like you said, with the NWA stuff. Really fighting for the big title change from Luthez, dropping the title to Bronco Nagurski. By the way, I don't know if anybody's ever seen this, but one time I watched like some Bronco Nagurski matches, and he was awesome. Like he was like a 1930s version of Stan Hansen, almost like a proto version. Not exactly the same, but like I was a fan of Bronco.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. I know the name, but I've never actually watched any of his stuff.
Yeah, he was a football player as well time. But, yeah, like he was very interesting to watch. I was very surprised because, like, a lot of that old, super old stuff is, like, super boring, like, to be honest. But he had a little bit more action to him than a lot of these other guys. Anyway, he did a lot there. He was done with a lot of major shows. Like you said, instrumental in NWA. Started one of the original cage matches as well, with a fence match. So he's a guy that is a really great candidate. I do think, like Bobby Davis, a lot of his stuff is so long ago that I don't know how many will appreciate him fully, which is kind of an issue.
Think as a promoter, that's easier thing to make than, say, someone like Bobby Davis as a manager.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's going to be interesting to see where he came in. And again, using the Don Owen bar, I think he would be a better candidate.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
So only a couple left now. Tony Schiavone here. What do you think of?
Well, you know, as I said about commentators and announcers and everything, like, it's going to affect about, like, what you grew up on. And yeah, I'm a Tony Schiavone voter. I'm going to admit it. He really was a great commentator until, like, 1998, I would say. And I mean, he's really incredible if you go and watch, like, the old, like, Lake Crockett and, like, early WCW on TBS. And, like, obviously, like, he had his dark look where he's, A, left the business, but also pissed off not only fans, but pissed off other people in the business. Like, he famously had a major falling out with Bobby Heenan. But, you know, to be fair to Tony, he sort of, you know, admitted that and said, like, look, I it's my fault that my relationship with Bobby Heenan fell off everything, and apologized and owned up to it. So, I mean, I can respect that. And, I mean, he's really redeemed himself in AEW. Like, I think he's, like, one of the best commentators they have, actually.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that of the guys they have, he's still one of the better ones. He's a guy that, again, I think a lot of it's going to depend on where. And we have a lot of his stuff that you can see. You know, like, a lot of people have come in. So you can point to that. You know, he is the voice of WCW at a major, major time period. Had a long-term
Multiple
impact.
Major time periods, if you really think about it. Because he's there in, like, peak Horseman in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then, again, in, like, you know, peak NWO and everything.
Yeah, that's completely true. There are times where he was great, and then there's times where he just didn't care at all. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to blame him with some of the stuff they were putting out there in WCW, to be honest.
Well, I think he was a bit of a prick, too, apparently.
Backstage manipulator, I guess you'd say.
He had a falling out with Jim Ross, too, because, like, he tried to go for, like, running WCW position when JR did at the same time, and then ended up going to Bischoff.
Right. There was all the stuff with Bobby Heenan as well. They had a falling out at the end. So that's a good point as well.
But unlike some people in the wrestling business, he has shown contrition.
That's true. Like I said, he's kind of made good the last few years with this AEW run. If he had never shut up at AEW, I think his rep would be, like, a lot worse.
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, like, see, he came back to MLW in 2017, and people were watching, and they're like, oh, shit, Tony Schiavone is still good. And that's, I mean, Tony Khan probably would have hired Tony Schiavone anyway.
But, yeah.
Because obviously, like, what Tony Khan loves, but.
Yeah.
But to be fair to Schiavone, he came out and worked for MLW to sort of, like, get his name back out there and did a good job.
Yeah, and he's a talented commentator. He's good, you know, in all honesty. I really respect his work. I wouldn't say he's as good as Dave Brown, but he has national impact that Brown doesn't have. So I think that's going to really help him a lot. And he's still in a popular promotion all these years later, even after, like, a 15 years absence or whatever, or 20 years.
Now, it will be interesting to see how much of the stink still is on him, because I know there's going to be people that are still be like, no, I'm not going to vote for him because it's like 2000 WCWers.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it feels like this, he, like I said, his national impact will give him an edge to the voters. I think I would vote for others before him, but he's not somebody that I think is a bad candidate at all. I think he has a very strong case to put in there. So it'll be interesting. Like you said, it's going to be interesting to see, will his rep at WCW precede him, or will his new, like, much more positive era that he's in on right now, the last few years, really help him? I think he's going to have a good run, actually. Like, my gut says that he's going to get some votes this year.
Yeah.
George Scott coming up next. Speaking of another Mid-Atlantic reference here, the Booker of Mid-Atlantic. He also had, like, a year or so runs in WWF. in like 84 and then WCW at the end of the tail end of the decade. What do you think about George Scott?
I mean, it's impressive, especially at the beginning. Also, like, because he was also had a major hand in, he bought into Toronto when it was really hot in the late 70s, because they were using a lot of mid-Atlantic talent there. So he's got a bit of even like a functional thing that you can put on him. But I just don't think it quite reaches that highest of Hall of Fame level highs. And then he just bounces around, right?
Yeah, and actually his later runs were kind of bad. Like, like, you know,
I mean, he was like involved backstage in setting up like the first couple of WrestleManias and some big shows then, but like I just don't.
And you have to figure that the big picture stuff was Vince even
and
then.
Pat Patterson.
Yeah, and Pat Patterson, you're right.
So yeah, I mean, if you can give me like some like uncensored details of like what exactly was going on backstage in some of these things, right?
Well, he's probably most famous for really giving Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and Nature Boy Ric Flair, and he was like the mastermind of Flair's transformation into the Nature Boy. Flair, when he originally started, wanted to be a cowboy, not the Nature Boy, but he was very influential in changing that into the Nature Boy gimmick, and I think that's obviously a big deal. But like I said, that said, he really became a dinosaur, like in WCW. His run in WCW nearly tanked the promotion in the late 80s because here's the thing. He, like so many others before and even after him, we saw it with Watts and all the rest, he didn't have the ability to understand that it wasn't the territory days anymore. He needed to think about TV too, not just the live audiences. The territory days were not around, and things really tanked bad with things that happened there. And there was an infamous show he did in New Orleans that like really screwed up, and I think that kind of led to like, listen, he was so bad they brought in Jim Herd to succeed him on there, which is a negative in and of itself. But here's the thing: he had successes in Mid-Atlantic, and even so, and when he was in WWF, he helped bring in some of those guys like Ricky Steamboat and all of that for the first few WrestleManias. He was influential in that sense, but wasn't really around long enough to do much good or anything like that just directly. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but personally, but he did have his successes. He has stuff you can point to if you're a supporter of his.
Absolutely. And it's sort of interesting, like when you brought up Watts obviously falling off too, like he'll have like people also sometimes forget that Watts lasted like 1 month in the WWF in 1995.
Yeah, that's right.
And the thing is though, like though, but we can look to Watts is that he had like great success that he did himself that we know that he was pretty much behind in Mid-South the 80s that I think obviously made him a Hall of Fame booker. And also I just have to get this dig in. Also, you know, Cornette falls into that list of people that lose touch with booking.
And he hates George Scott. Yeah, he's criticized George Scott as like a terrible booker. So it's funny how, like, to him, George Scott was like this old guy who didn't understand crap about wrestling. And then Cornette would go on in his Ring of Honor run and everything like that, which is pretty infamous in his own right. But, yeah, so to me, he's not a Hall of Famer, but, you know, he has stuff you can point to.
You can make a case, yeah, absolutely.
Mike Tenay, another commentator that I think everybody knows.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't think so. I was never a TNA guy. I watched like the big matches, and I enjoyed like, you know, him and Don West team are fun. I just don't think it's like an all-time thing. You know, I don't have a lot to say about Mike Tenay. I like him. That I would take some gambling tips from Mike.
Is that Hall of Fame worthy?
You know, well, your mileage may vary on that. I'm not really big, much of a, but I would certainly take his advice.
Okay.
But, you know, I just don't think he is Hall of Fame level with his commentator.
To me, even in TNA, Wes stood out more than him, in my opinion. I think he was better at WCW. I think TNA mismanaged him, actually. If he had been used as more of a color commentator instead of the lead guy, I think he would have been way better in that role. And I don't know why they didn't do that. But, I mean, Jeff said on his show that he wanted, like, the analyst and the fan's voice was kind of like his idea, which I get that, but I think him and TNA had so much to offer as a color guy at WCW, it helped really get a lot of these cruiserweight guys that, you know, these other guys, Schiavone and Dusty Rhodes and Bobby Heenan, probably didn't care about that much. He was able to get them over and give context to them, to the audience. So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's why I like TNA, because I learned things about international wrestling stars that I didn't know before. In some regard, you could say him is a bit of a precursor to Excalibur, just being that knowledge of like wrestling around the world.
Yeah, that's a very good comparison piece. I think his TNA run was not as good as his WCW run, personally, but I think it wasn't really his fault. But I'm with you. I don't see him as a Hall of Famer. I respect him as a lot, though.
Absolutely,
as a wrestling mind and a commentator overall, but just not a Hall of Fame player, in my opinion. I agree with you. Ted Turner. Now, this is a guy that's a very interesting candidate. What do you think about Ted?
So I'm voting for Ted Turner. I mean, he basically decided that wrestling would be very important for cable TV when it sort of started launching in the late 70s and early 80s. And he was correct, and he changed the face of wrestling.
Yeah, to me, I mean, this is like Kidani, but an American version last year. Like, it's an open and shut case.
He's even less hands-on than Kidani was.
Yeah, yeah, but, exactly. That's the one negative you're going to point to if you're not a voter of his.
But like Bobby Bruns, it was just what he did once that all done, and he's in there, right, as far as I can see.
And like if Ted Turner doesn't exist, the wrestling world is so mind-bogglingly different that you can't, like, it's impossible to take that away. Like, to me, he is a slam dunk. Yes, to me.
Yeah, because I think a lot of other television executives at that time when cable was launching probably wouldn't touch wrestling, but he did, because he's obviously from the South and everything like that.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, it took someone like from with his experience and where he was from to identify what wrestling could be on cable.
Yeah, like, to me, he's like one of the easiest yeses on the category. To me,
I'm surprised that he wasn't a slam dunk. I like, this is not his first time on the ballot.
I felt the same way about Kidani last year, but it feels like there's people like with these owners and promoters that will use exactly what you said, say, oh, well, he didn't really influence it directly, so
he didn't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he didn't have to. But that doesn't mean it's not like it doesn't count. Like, you know, at the end of the day, it still happened. You know, to me, he's like an easy yes. So, good job on your part voting for Ted Turner. That's a good vote on your part, in my opinion. Roy Welch, another Tennessee guy here. Really famous for working with Nick Gulas and the wrestling family there. He had his own wrestling family with the Fullers later on. He was around from like the late 30s to the mid 1970s, drew a lot, basically laid the building blocks for Jerry Jarrett to come in to Memphis. What do you think about Roy Welch?
So I guess I always heard Gulas's name mentioned more, but it was sort of like the way that Tennessee and Alabama was divided up, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah. So like there was different parts of this whole thing. Like there was obviously the Memphis.
Was it basically like sub territories within the territory?
Yeah, that's a good way. That's the best way I can think of to explain it.
Yeah,
because there was like Memphis, Nashville, Alabama, like had one. Kentucky had one, and it was like all, you know, the Gulas and like I said, I think Gulas is probably more noteworthy or known at least or talked about than Welch. But if you ask a lot of the legends, like I'm sure, if somebody sent in a question to Jeff Jarrett on his show, he would know. He would be able to tell you a lot about Roy Welch, I bet.
Yeah. There's definitely something there, but I don't know. It just seemed to me like Jarrett and Gulas.
Yeah.
Well, Jarrett obviously came later, but Gulas was more in Welch. That doesn't necessarily disqualify Welch, but I don't know. I just haven't been able to see like how Welch was like the overwhelming central part. Yes, that makes sense.
To me, he's a better candidate than Don Owen, but probably less so than the others. Like, Morris Siegel would be ahead of him in my book. And I had Ted Turner, obviously, as well.
Right.
So in this ballot, he wouldn't be in my top five or whatever. But like I said, he's got a case. I think if somebody more of his era would speak up for him more,
definitely,
and say why he was as important as Gulas and Jerry Jarrett and all of that, I think we could get more clarity on it. But with the information we have now, I would put him ahead of some of these other guys.
Right. That, I agree with that. Yeah, that's what.
Stanley Weston, said by virtually everyone, if Bill Apter's in, he should be in. But like Welch, is he better than the rest of the ballot here? So what say you on Weston?
Well, you know, I was reading his biography, and is there a Boxing Hall of Fame? Because you could probably make a better case that he's in the Boxing
Hall of Fame. There is, in fact, a Boxing Hall of Fame.
There's a better case for him being in the Boxing Hall of Fame than the Wrestling Hall of Fame. Because I think he was more important to, like, boxing media than wrestling media. Not that he wasn't important to wrestling media, right? He really was the brains. And, of course, Bill Apter, being the worker, managed to sort of make himself a much bigger celebrity, even though he started it. But, like...
If you don't know, like, Weston was the guy who started PWI. Like, he was the main guy behind that. And a lot of other stuff as well. Weston was actually inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame.
See. Well, I would agree that he deserves it there, just reading about what he's done in boxing media. There's a case there. I mean, those magazines were very important. But, I mean, they did decline. Like...
This is another thing, like another simple where it's like, if we had, how do you measure influence? Like, because he was, the magazines were clearly important and influential for their time, but now we're past that time. But that stuff still counts, in my opinion. Like,
I agree. And I think, I mean, in 1999, I bought the PWI 500, and that was very, very important. Formative thing for me, and that was as late as 1999. Basically, because all of the Japanese wrestlers were in it, and that's I saw my first picture of Mitsuhara Misawa in that magazine. So I didn't know who he was before that magazine.
Okay.
I believe that year was Austin number one, Goldberg number two, I think, or maybe it was The Rock. But Misawa was number three in 1999, 500. There's a picture of him giving a Tiger Driver to Kobashi. Yeah, very important.
Well, I think it clearly fell off this year when Hikaru Sato was not in the PWI 500. I think was the moment we could point to the collapse.
What I'm saying is, though, those magazines were actually quite important well into the era.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. I
don't think they really – but once WWE – sort of falls in like 2001, 2002, I don't think there's much of they never recover, do they? Really?
Yeah, their influence is like way lower now than it was 2 to 3 decades ago, and obviously before that. I think anyone would agree with that.
But there was a good... I mean, they were around in the 70s, so you're looking at 30 years of import. When's that wrestling magazine first start? But I feel like they don't really get big until the 70s.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. I don't know. But, you know, we're looking at least around 30 years. So that's definitely important.
Like I said, I agree with the people that say if Apter's in, he should be in. But, it's tough for me to say he's above some of these other guys in the category.
Exactly.
You know. So I think that's – like, they've set the bar. If Apter's in, he should be in. I agree with that. But will I vote for him over these other five guys that are better candidates, in my opinion? That's where the problem – like, if things clear out, there's guys that go in or guys that fall off and things thin out, I think he has a better shot. But I think with the class right now, I think there would be others you would put ahead of him.
Definitely.
So then the last one, the Grand Wizard of Wrestling. Here, the legendary manager in the WWF. What do you think of the Grand Wizard?
Well, he's got a decent amount of longevity. I think, like, really the people leading the charge for the Grand Wizard is basically anyone that grew up watching, like, Worldwide Wrestling Federation in the 70s and early 80s, basically from, like, you know, Bruno and Pedro to Backlund. They would obviously think that the Grand Wizard is one of the greatest managers of all time. You can't really say that the Grand Wizard was that innovative because obviously that's Bobby Davis. And, like, I don't know, what sort of lasting influence did he have on the business? That I'm a little less clear on.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, it's like anything you can point to, I agree with you. I thought, and I looked at it, and I did the research, and I came away with the opinion that Davis is a better candidate than him. But I think he's just, like, not old enough Grand Wizard. He was around at a short enough period of time to where more people will recognize him and have those childhood memories, like you said, or memories of him in person, even. So I think that that's going to really help his case. But to me, I think Davis is the better candidate of the two. Clearly, he also really innovated, like, blatant manager interference, which to me is a negative influence of anything, because we see that so progressively now. That to me should be, like, outlawed in wrestling if I was the president of all wrestling.
I guess we should address this is, do you think that Bobby Heenan is a Hall of Famer based on his being a manager alone?
Oh, man, that's tough because his comment, like, to me, I, again, because I'm younger,
yep,
I know him more as the commentator.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, so that's...
I suppose you could put those two together and make a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that at the end of the day. I think Heenan would be a Hall of Famer overall, but I just, I don't know his managerial work as well as people older than me is the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I wouldn't vote for Grand Wizard, honestly, of the top five. I think... Yeah,
but I know there are. He's got like a core of supporters, absolutely.
Yeah, and like I said, the people who are intimately familiar with his work, I think, really love him as well. So yeah, I agree with all of that. But overall, we look at the ballot here. We've talked about everybody. Good stuff there. Before we move on to the rest of your ballot, where we're just going to focus on the non-wrestler for this. Who do you have in mind to vote? Maybe, and like I said, we were talking off the air, and you said you were about 90% sure. About who you're going to vote for. Who right now, as we talk, is your five for this?
For non-wrestlers?
Yeah. You can also make up names if you would like.
No, and I'm pretty confident on these five. I think you could probably figure it out after what we talked about. But
yeah.
Shinshiro Takagi, Bobby Bruns, Morris Siegel, Tony Schiavone, and Ted Turner.
All I heard was Dave Brown wasn't voted in at the end of the day, so I don't approve of this ballot. But no, you made your cases there. It's going to be interesting to see how this ballot of like a lot of the categories. I think this is a very deep one, and I think a major issue, kind of to circle back to what I said at the start, is these are so many different types of players here, where it's a referee, a manager, a belt maker, a music guy. It's like it's hard to compare all of them in general. But at the same time, these guys are on the ballot because they're the top of their position. You know, there's no music guy that could ever compare to Jim Johnston.
Oh, not giving respect to Jimmy Hart, are we?
Hey, listen, well, he was an actual musician, to be fair. But he, if there was a Hall of Fame for ripping off popular songs and making them into theme music, he would be a top tier candidate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's better than Dale Oliver. DNA of ripping off songs, to be honest. But yeah, you know, there's no belt maker that can compare to Reggie Parks. I mean, there's other guys that have done it, but they're not on his level. So that's why they're here. But I think it makes for a tough category overall to when you're comparing all these different people. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out because there's a wide variety of names. This feels like, to me, my gut is telling me a log jam is coming in this category, yep, to be perfectly honest. But we will see what happens. Like I said, I thought Kidani was like a slam dunk.
And I think the log jam will also happen because there's still territory guys on here. And
yeah.
It always creates like pockets of support.
Yeah, I agree.
Talking about with like the Grand Wizard and everything.
Yeah, and even people that are way before, like, you know, Bobby Davis is before everybody's time, practically. Yeah. So it's going to be tough to categorize those type of guys. But it's interesting. So you are voting for three different categories. I had Kayson, and we talked about two. What are – well, four, technically, counting the non-wrestlers, but three different wrestler categories. Which one do you want to go to first? We're going to go through your ballot here. It's not going to be as in-depth as this stuff.
Do you want to do Japan first or last? Because I think that's where we'll have some fruitful discussion given our interests.
Okay, that could be the main event. We're gonna, the main event segment is Japan.
So actually, let's work backwards and start with historical U.S. and North America, because I think it's very interesting things. So historical, I'm going with. I'll go through them all first, and then we'll talk.
Yeah.
Or okay. So June Byers, and then Pampero Furpo. And then Antonino / Argentina Roca and Miguel Perez and Johnny Rougeau. And then this is where I get the eight. So Tiger Jeet Singh, Wild Bull Curry, Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon, and Enrique Torres.
So I'm seeing your Canadian bias stick out with some of these candidates, clearly, much like when you defend your boy Jericho at AEW. No, I'm just kidding. Let me just run over the whole class real quick, and we'll talk about your votes here. So other guys that were on the ballot in comparison to those guys were the team of Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura, Ole Anderson, Bullet Bob Armstrong, the Briscoes, Jack and Jerry, June Byers, Wild Bill Curry, you mentioned British Bulldogs, Dynamite Kid, and Davey Boy Smith as a team, Cowboy Bob Ellis, Pantera Furpo, you mentioned them, Black Gordman and Great Goliath, Mongolian Stomper, Archer Goldie, Hart Foundation, team of Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, Soul Man Rocky Johnson, The Rockers, Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, Sputnik Monroe, Blackjack Mulligan, Harley Race and Larry Hennig, Dusty Rhodes, Dick Murdoch, Argentina Roca and Miguel Perez, Johnny Rougeau, Kenji Shibuya and Masa Saito, Tiger Jeet Singh, Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, Enrique Torres, Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon, the Von Brauners and Sal Wengeroff, and Mr. Wrestling 1 and 2. So that's the entire category. A lot of people in this historical category. And you, and this one, they specialize, or Dave specialized that you could vote for eight instead of just five here. And you named your eight. So let's run through them, your candidates here. Which one do you want to talk about first?
Well, June Byers, because she's very interesting.
She would have been one of my – you had a couple that would have been my votes, and she was one of them, for the record.
I mean, she was basically the big – the she took over from Mildred Burke as the biggest women's star in the United States. I don't think she was quite as big as a star as Burke, but she had good longevity throughout all of the 1950s into the early 1960s when she was eventually superseded by the Fabulous Moolah, who's now been canceled. So, you know, I think that sort of obviously like reflects on Byers even stronger in some ways. And like she was a very solid draw, not super solid, but like lots of 5,000 plus shows. And I think that's for women's wrestling at that time as the top draw, mind you. I think that should be enough to get her in the Hall of Fame, really.
Yeah, she was the last women's star at her level for 50-plus years.
Because it ruined it.
Yeah, exactly. But listen, whatever the reasons behind it, she was the last star at her level for 50 or 60 years until they kind of moved forward with the Four Horsewoman era and all that stuff. To me, she is a legend and a Hall of Famer, in my opinion. Like, that's kind of one of the things, again, I said at the start. What I look for is people that are true legends, and I think she totally fills that category. So I think that's a great vote. I have no argument there. What's your next pick there?
So Pampero Furpo. Now, he's not someone that I've seen a lot of, but, you know, I did some digging into him because this is another, like, sort of Dave bias in effect, but he ended up retiring in, like, Northern California in the Bay Area. So, like, Dave knew him and his daughter. So that's how sort of like when Pampero passed away just a couple of years ago, like Dave gave that passing a lot of attention. And so I started really looking into him. And, you know, originally from Argentina, he sort of came and had some great success in the States. He was had like, look, he headlined some large gates in Boston and Madison Square Garden against Pedro Morales in the WWWF. He was arguably the number three star in Detroit behind Sheik and Bobo Brazil in like the early 70s. And then he also had success all over the place in Texas and in Hawaii. And Randy Savage ripped off his promo style. So that's, I think, like, if you really look into it, it is actually quite impressive. And it's sort of interesting that his sort of notoriety fell off compared to some of his contemporaries, much more well-known.
One of the original hardcore, wrestlers along with that. Yeah, big run in Detroit, things like that. Interesting case there to be made for him. And yeah, like you said, he had the same catchphrase as Macho Man, as well, the "ooh yeah" and all that. Interesting case there for sure. He's not somebody I originally looked at, but he's a guy that I will do look more into now that you've given him his props there. But yeah,
I'm about 30 years, so he's got the longevity too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. These historical guys and girls are like, you know, it's tough to quantify in ring with a lot of them, you know, at the end of the day, no matter who it is, almost, you know. So that kind of skews us a little bit as younger voters overall. But, yeah, I think that, like, what you said is very interesting overall. You made a very good case for him. He's somebody I want to look more into. Because I had the people that I would vouch for, and he wasn't really one of them in my mind. But I'm looking more into him. I think that he's an interesting pick. So good job on your part. Who's next?
We got Antonino Rocca and Miguel Perez. I mean, they were like the biggest draws as a tag team.
Yeah, this was another one that I definitely had as an easy yes.
And then Rocca, Rocca was obviously a draw on his own, but like, you know, I mean, in the 50s and into the 60s, like, tag teams were draws,
right?
Which I think does benefit sort of Dave putting the tag teams on there, because you had a lot of tag teams from that time that none of them could get in as either an individual or only one of them can get in, like Rocca, because there's not much to Perez as a singles, really. And it's like a no-brainer, really, given the level of business doing at the time.
Like I said, to me, they were like one of the standout players, like, in this group that should be one of the top vote-getters, in my opinion. I think that their legacy in the New York territory is so strong as draws that they have to be considered, like, you know, top tier. But, you know, so I really have, again, I don't have any argument against them. I think they're great picks. They stood out to me as one of the top candidates. So who's next?
Johnny Rougeau. He is sort of the fifth largest draw in the history of Quebec wrestling. Drew 3 of the 20 highest attendances in the history of Quebec. And so that's like his core. But he was also a regular in sort of parts of the Midwest and in Florida, where he actually did some good business as well. So I think just based on, like, his drawing ability, particularly in Montreal, like, I think he should be in there.
Yeah, you know, he's definitely a guy. And, like, all of these guys in the historical candidacy to get on, you know, feel like legends to me more than a lot of the newer guys. To be honest with you. And he's very important. Again, I'm not as personally familiar with him, to be honest with you, but he's a guy that I know he definitely has a really strong case. And especially,
yes, he is like the Rougeau, like the patriarch of the Rougeau family. I'm already aware of that.
Yeah, like Jacques, yeah. Ray, you know, all that stuff. You know, so that's good as well. Shout out to Johnny Rougeau. Like I said, again, we can't really compare him as a wrestler, like in ring. You know, we didn't live through his era, but as a legend, he definitely has a case, and definitely one of the top stars of Quebec at the time. So, good pick there. What about next?
Tigerjeet Singh.
You wrote about him.
I wrote a piece on Voices of Wrestling about it. Like, the man was a draw for, like, a solid draw for 20 years in Japan. There were maybe a little, like, ups and downs. But, I mean, in 1992, he, like, headlined a show at Yokohama Stadium against Atsushi Onita in a death match that drew 30,000 people. And as recently as 2004, he headlined Hustle 6 against Naoya Ogawa and drew, like, 7,700. So that's 30 years into his, like, debut in Japan. You know, multiple doing 10,000. Than 10,000 against Inoki and Baba. Had also a tag team feud. I'm totally blanked. But they feuded with Seiji Sakaguchi and Strong Kobayashi for the NWA North American tag team titles, which were sort of New Japan's tag team titles before the IWGP tag team titles. And he challenged with a number of partners, but it was like the Sakaguchi and Kobayashi team that sort of like was the one that drew some big houses too. So just longevity, the gates, like obviously like there's a lot of parallels to him with Abdullah the Butcher, and Abdullah was a bigger star worldwide, but Singh did headline in 1980 and 1981 a number of shows at a stadium in Necropon for the UWA. The attendances are not there in all cases, but there was a UWA title match that he had against Al Canek that did draw 20,000. So I think you can also put that as a little extra feather in his cap.
Very innovative in the work shoot angle as well, attacking Inoki. Yeah.
Some may also regret that ever happened to
a negative influence.
But yes, he did the famous work shoot angle where he ambushed Inoki, his then wife, at a shopping mall in Tokyo and slapped them both.
That is true. You know, another like prototypical comparing him to Abdullah the Butcher was the correct comparison. Monster heel foreigner in Japan during that era, and the bloody brawl crazy guy. You know, nobody's going to consider him the next, you know, the precursor to Bryan Danielson.
Funny because I was going back and watching both like 70s Singh and 70s Butcher. Butcher is so much better than him.
Yeah.
About that.
Hey, that's true. I mean, he really wasn't good, but you know, he's a legend at the end of the day.
Absolutely, a draw, and it's what it is.
Yeah, and even in Canada, he's still considered a legend as well.
Yeah, like the thing in Canada is like he was like an upper mid carder in Toronto in the '70s. That's really about it. The reason that he has a school named after him is from his like after he left retired, he became like a philanthropist. He's still got a charity going. That's why he's got a school named after. Not so much for the wrestling.
Yeah. So that's an interesting pick there. He's definitely a huge draw and like a legendary performer of the time. So I think it's interesting that, you know, I was reading your article and you said he was on the ballot like 23 years ago and fell off. And now this is his first time back. So I think that's very interesting.
My theory on that is a lot of the historians and the journalists at the time were a lot more like incredibly work rate heavy. That's a theory. I cannot tell you that for sure, but that's my hunch.
I mean, we're going to see this year how it plays out with him, you know, how things are going to come. So that's interesting. And the good thing about the historical is the 8 voters, so you get a little bit more wiggle room to vote for some extra people. He's going to be an interesting case study now, all these years later, how opinion has changed on him as time has gone along. Who's next?
Wild Bull Curry. I mean, he was an innovator, and he had a long career. I think he wasn't the biggest draw, but he definitely has like drawing credentials that lasted a very long time. So I think on that sort of mixture of historical significance and longevity and drawing, you can make a case for him. He did like shape the wrestling that we watch today for better or worse.
Another one of these hardcore type of guys, like at the start,
the real original.
Yeah. Like I said, he's another one of those types, similar to some of the other ones you were talking about, with Furpo and even Tiger Jeet Singh as well. You know, like you said, very influential ultimately. Interesting look at him. To be honest with you, he didn't stand out to me. Like when I looked at these the candidates, he wasn't one of the original guys I looked at, but he's a guy I will look at. And like I said, I know a bit about him. It's going to be interesting. And I know he got some super, like, heated stuff in his time as well. Like he was able to be like a master of getting heat, like crowd heat at the time as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how he does. Who's next?
So Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon. This wasn't a team that stuck out to me. I know who they both are, especially like Mad Dog. But I wanted to research all of these sort of, especially some of the tag teams and everything like that. Right. Cause you know, you look at the tag teams that are on there and, like, some of the other ones, like Texas Outlaws, which is, like, Rhodes and Murdoch, and, like, Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura shouldn't be even on there. They don't really have much of a case at all.
Okay.
So when I got to Mad Dog and Butcher, they actually have an incredible amount of longevity and draws both in AWA and in Quebec for like well through the 60s, 70s, and even into the early 80s. So I think multiple territories, longevity and drawing,
it was easy for me.
It's interesting because, like, kind of what we've said some on some guys where so and so was more standout to me. I had heard much more about Mad Dog on his own than them as a tag team, to be perfectly honest with you. So I will give this team a look. Like I said, I had really known more about Mad Dog on his own than the team itself. So they have a lot of longevity. That's going to be interesting to look at to see how that does.
Strong in multiple territories, I think, is a really interesting thing when you're looking at people from the territory days.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say so. That's interesting. That's something I definitely will look forward into because I always think, oh, as a team, like you'd think Mad Dog would be the guy, but you are vouching for them and their drawing ability. So we will see what happens with them. Who's next?
So last historical is
Enrique Torres, right?
Enrique Torres, not someone that I had heard of a lot before. I'd only had heard of in the last couple of years because, you know, Dave finds these guys to put on the ballot. I mean, it's incredible. Like, he sort of enters wrestling in 1946 in LA. So it's more of like a SoCal guy. Is immediately like a sensation, like a big stars, like sort of Mexican-American superstar in Southern California. He does all these record gates and all over the West Coast. He's got he had a tag team run with Bobo Brazil and was basically a huge draw all through the 1950s and early 1960s.
To me, he was and is like one of the strongest overall candidates on the block. Like, I can't believe he's not in already. And he has gotten a lot of support over the years. It's like he just hasn't been able to get over that hump. To me, when you look at his career, not just in California, but even later on with his brothers as a tag team, he was a big deal even to the 60s. Like, he had a ton of – he had a long run, great stuff going on in terms of being a draw in California. To me, he's like a slam dunk candidate. Very easy. I've advocated for him a lot over the years, and I think that he's a guy that should definitely be in. He would probably be, like, if I were only vote for one person, it'd probably be him. Out of all the candidates, I think he's an excellent, excellent candidate that deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think if you take the time to go and look up these names, I think you'll find a lot of interesting things, and some slam dunks is my opinion after sure.
Yeah, and he's like right near the top of the list. So you used all 8 of your votes here. You did a good job there. So you got all the candidates in there. What about the U.S.? We'll go through your candidates here. I've kind of already touched on a lot of these guys with Case. So what do you say about the U.S. candidates you voted for?
So I will go through order, and I will save the last one, who is sort of someone that I'm willing to swap out when I go with it. So I've got Junkyard Dog, Kevin Carey and David Von Erich, Sergeant Slaughter, Paul Orndorff, and Bill Goldberg.
Okay, for a second I thought you were going to say CM Punk and make me mad again.
No.
But thankfully you went with a much better candidate in Goldberg, I would say. The other guys on the ballot we went through them again: Tully and Arn, Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee, Edge, Matt and Jeff Hardy, Becky Lynch, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Paul Orndorff, you mentioned him as well. Randy Orton, New Age Outlaws, CM Punk, Roman Reigns, Trish Stratus, and the Steiner Brothers. So, you used all 5 of your picks here again as well. JYD, what made you pick Junkyard Dog? Again, I want to shout out Rich Latta's article he wrote about him as well. Voice of Wrestling, you did a great job in there. But
article.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I do value longevity, but when you like hit as high as Junkyard Dog does, like, I'm willing to overlook that, and we get into that when we talk about Goldberg a little later too. And one thing is that I don't think a lot of people really bother looking into, because obviously, like, his WWF run was obviously like on the downside of his career. Like, in 84 and 85 and even into early 86, he's headlining a lot of B shows. Actually, he headlined a lot of shows against Terry Funk on those B shows on the WWF tours. They were drawing like 5, 6, 7, 8,000 people, fairly common. So I think you have to sort of add that in there. So I think if you put that together with what he was able to do in some of those, like, is it the Superdome in New Orleans? That's the name of the stadium?
Yeah, it is the Superdome.
Yeah, Superdome. Like, I think he's in there.
To me, of the U.S. candidates, he's one of the top ones. To me, I think his influence is so strong. Like you said, his peak was so high. I know at the time, you know, you go back to a lot of the observers, and Meltzer himself even wasn't a big fan of JYD, to be honest with you. But he's a guy, I think, his legacy is so strong, like, that he has to be in. He would be one of my votes for sure on this list. I mean, you know, if I were to vote in U.S., he would be right near the top. Who's your next one?
So, the Von Erichs. I mean, none of them are Hall of Famers on their own, especially David.
He passed away so young. Yeah.
Young, but, like, they drew a lot of money as a group, and you just can't deny that. So it seems pretty clear to me that, as a unit, that they should be in there.
Yeah, you know, they're a legendary group in Texas territory. They definitely had a lot of ups and downs, like, business-wise, in terms of just, like, behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, going on. You know, obviously, because the Dallas territory ended up really, like, falling off, you know, at the end of the day. And Kerry was never able to have a super big success, you know, in WWF or anything as Texas Tornado. But he's a guy that was very popular at the time as well. Von Erich family, very legendary. I think it's interesting that they've kind of separated these three together, you know, as a thing, instead of just saying the whole family, you know, at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, other than Fritz, none of the other members could have any real stake claim of drawing.
This is another one. There's some on Japan that was, it feels like to me, like, okay, Kerry didn't get in, but a lot of people want him in, so we're going to try and, like, cheese him in with this new tag team. I'm not saying it's even a problem. It just feels like we're trying to get a guy who was in on his own, and now we're doing this rigmarole, pretty much.
I guess, but I just feel like the Von Erichs are so huge, and they did draw, like, they stayed in Texas, but they did draw in Florida and in St. Louis, too.
Yeah, I'm saying nothing against them as a candidate at all. It just feels like maybe they should have just been on there in the first place.
Yeah.
Maybe we were going to do that at the end of the day. But, yeah, you know, I really have no argument against them. They're legendary in their territory. You know, the territory area, if you're going to count that, you have to count them as one of the big historic draws of their era, especially as a family. So, yeah, I really have no problem with this vote here. You know, they don't pop the way JYD does to me, but they're definitely not somebody I think like if you'd said Randy Orton, I would be like, what? But, you know, there's some, there's not just him. There's like multiple ones here that I'm like, these people are not Hall of Famers in any way, shape or form. And the Von Erichs don't strike me as that.
Well, I don't know if this is my hottest take, but I would, if someone put a gun to my head and told me to vote for either Randy Orton or Edge, I would take Randy Orton over Edge.
Wow, turning on your Canadian for once here with Orton here. So that's interesting. I don't know, man. Edge, I don't like either of them. So it's like we're really, you know, there's your scraping. And the thing is, Meltzer loves those guys. Like Edge and Orton, if you read a lot of his stuff, he always put them over huge.
In real time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in real time as well. He actually kind of turned on Orton last year for the Hall of Fame, where he was like, nah, like, you know, it's like for a while he was a big proponent of his, but to me, and I think he's a guy that's very, I think his rep, this is just a theory of mine, he was easy to work with for a lot of these guys, and that you didn't have to work hard because he wasn't going to work hard for most of the time. And that kind of made him over with the boys, so to speak. And he got a lot, cause you see a lot of the wrestlers, they're like, ah, Orton's one of the best. He's an amazing performer. It's like, no, he's not one of the best anything. He's not good at all, in my opinion, but he got very over with the boys, I think, and that helped his, you know, ref a little bit. But, Orton over Edge, I could buy that, but to me, they're both, those would both be guys I would say, these are guys who are not Hall of Famers.
I agree, yeah.
To shout them out. But, yeah, Von Erichs, JYD, who's next?
Sergeant Slaughter. I mean, he's got a lot of things going for him, in my opinion. Like, he's been a draw. He was an incredible worker. Like, sort of set that mold for the big guy that can really move and bump. And, I mean, I think it matters that he was a household name, right? Like, that is the level of, fame, right, that he got through G.I. Joe and everything. I mean, that sort of led to him leaving WWF. But, I mean, and then to go to AWA, and he drew in the AWA for a bit. But I think if you go back into the 70s and everything,
feuds in Mid-Atlantic and in an early, even like pre-Hogan WWF. I think he's got everything there.
To me, he's a Hall of Famer. Like he's a top tier candidate in the U.S. side to me. Great worker too in a lot of his Mid-South stuff. I know he's more known for the WWF, but his time early on in the 80s, he was like really strong performer and doesn't get enough credit. And even like the later on in his heel turn, him and Hogan had some great brawls. Like stuff, he didn't really draw, like, because that whole angle was so stupid that like it messed everything up. But their actual work was actually really good, even in the 90s as his heel run. But he's not really known as much for that. As a star, like you said, he peaked in the 80s, the G.I. Joe stuff. Like you said, a very famous name to a lot of people, non-wrestling fans even. I know that it's been brought up that Dave kind of brings up his AWA run that wasn't that good in terms of drawing as something that keeps him off. But I think his star power was so high that even one bad run, you can't really just override everything.
He kind of drew up for a bit, but then, yeah, it fell off fast. But that's, like, also what was going on in the AWA at that time.
Yeah. But to me, that's a great pick. You hit, like, to me, JYD and Sarge are, like, the top guys, like, in this category. And you hit both here. And then Von Erichs stood out as well. Who's your next pick?
Paul Orndorff.
Mr. Wonderful.
Again, someone that I would have never thought of thinking about of voting until, you know, obviously his untimely passing leads to people sort of get reexamined, right? And so you go and you look, and if I'll just start working backwards because it's easiest, but like a huge draw on the house show circuit against Hogan, including doing over 60,000 fans in Toronto. But he was also a draw in Memphis, in Mid-South, and in Georgia, and in Continental. So, I mean, I think that's like a very strong drawing resume. And he was a pretty good, darn good worker, at least until his like injuries on his arm caught up. But that was just a little past his peak in WWF.
Yeah, to me, he's a legend. Kind of underrated historically. Because I don't think he really lasted into the mainstream eras of WWF, unfortunately, and even that later run at WCW as well, wasn't the greatest, to be perfectly honest with you. But he's a guy that, if you look at his run, on top, he was like way bigger star than he gets remembered for. And I think this is another thing too. When it comes to WWF specifically or WWE now, I think a big part of it is. They control the narrative, you know, yeah. So to speak. Like, and he's not really one of their guys they ever point to as any kind of big guy. Compared to, let's say, Roddy Piper, who is always mentioned as that top guy at the time. Orndorff was actually up there at WWF as well, but they never really mentioned him. So he kind of falls by the wayside, I think, to a lot of the fans and voters alike.
Well, he had a much more interesting feud with Hogan anyway. And it's sort of funny that it sort of didn't get remembered as big as sort of like the Piper stuff, right? Because it was the whole like turning on Hogan and then using Real American as his theme song and everything like that, right? But it's like, and people that saw it watched it, but the legend of it is really like Piper and Hogan.
Yeah. And I think that, again, that's a part of them controlling history a little bit, you know, more than the reality of it. So I think that's a great pick on your part. I definitely, he'd be another guy I would strongly consider up there. And then we have your favorite. Goldberg.
Yes. Yeah, Goldberg. I mean, I'm willing to sub out Goldberg if, like, maybe if I do some more research or someone publishes something that makes me rethink about some of the other guys. You know, I mean, he did incredible business when he was on top. Probably kept WCW from closing earlier than it did, which is maybe, you know, sort of funny to think about. And, like, you know, you can point to some success in that WWF run in like what 03, even if it wasn't what it could have been, you know, you know, making money but not making as much money as he could have.
Go back to that SummerSlam Elimination Chamber match. That crowd took to him like a superstar, like the top star in the company.
Yeah.
And of course got killed off because Triple H is not a great wrestler. I would say at the time, not a great champion at the time.
And then he returns after 12 or 13 years. Because he comes back, I think, late 2016.
That's right.
Pops ratings and pops business for that little run.
Now, I don't think anything after that, though, with like that Undertaker match in Saudi Arabia or his matches against... did he ever have that match against Roman, or was it just against that Braun Strowman who subbed for Roman at that indoor WrestleMania during the pandemic? I can't remember.
Or did he
face Roman in Saudi?
Yeah, I'm vaguely remembering this now. Like this is a really dark era of WWE for me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of that really did the sort of business that his first comeback in 2016, 2017 did. But it's not enough to drag him down or anything. But I just think
He faced Roman in Saudi Arabia. I'm looking it up right now, and yeah, that was actually his last match was against Roman, was in Saudi Arabia. Okay. Yeah, Elimination Chamber earlier this year.
Oh, God, was it? Oh, my
God. Yeah, February 2022. How about that?
Yeah. But still, I think there's enough there just to get him past the finish line is the hard and how big he is and really sort of like the template of how you push a guy like that, too, now. There's look at what they do for Wardlow. Not quite the same, but the whole walking through the back and the chanting, everything like that.
Also, one of the best moves was when he squashed Bray Wyatt in like 2 minutes or whatever.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes.
So that definitely was a pop for me that needs to be. But here's the thing: to me, it was like diminishing returns when he first came back. You know, when he first came back, it was a huge deal, and they had all that deal with Brock Lesnar, and did a lot of great things with him. Like I said, I really thought that the match they had at WrestleMania was like one of the best. It was like a 5-minute match, but it was still so spirited and awesome that it was like one of the best matches WWE had that whole year. I think it was like 2017. It was right. Cause remember he won at Survivor Series and he won the title over Kevin Owens. It was like a really fast deal before WrestleMania. So it was basically like he beat Kevin so he could drop it to Brock at WrestleMania. But the Brock match at WrestleMania was like one of their best matches in general.
Yeah. I mean, it was always going to be diminishing returns after that Brock feud, but I mean, like, because of Vince's brain being mush,
it got
diminishing returns even faster than it could have.
Yeah, he's basically like a guy, hey, we've got the Saudi show, here's Goldberg. Like, that's basically where he's at now more than any kind of difference maker for the last 3-4 years at the end of the day. But still, though, like, his run at the top in WCW was one of the greatest runs of all time by any singular person, you know. So I think it's hard to argue that from anybody. And I really think, like, he ate a lot as a worker in terms of people saying he sucked. I don't think just anybody with a winning streak could have done what he did. Like, I think there was talent
and everything.
And even at times his wrestling, like, he was a great squash worker. And he also had, like, when it came down to it, his match versus DDP was a great match. Yes. That's Elimination Chamber I told you about. He was awesome in that match. He had a lot of athletic stuff that gets a little underrated. And of course, like, I know Bret Hart is not going to be happy.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny you bring him up because I was going to say at the end of this, I apologize to Bret Hart for voting.
Oh, yeah, this is another Canada. You're mixing it up. I appreciate that. You're not being so one-sided towards your Canadian fellows here. But I know that – listen, I love Bret Hart, man. I love even his negativity and all of that stuff. Is awesome.
Yes, it fits the gimmick, right, of being like the world's most serious wrestler.
Yeah, so he's very funny. One of my all-time favorite YouTube videos is him burying the universe. I play that every Christmas on Twitter. I will post that video just because it makes me so happy just for how he does it. But yes, I know he's not – he hates Goldberg's guts, and now I think he hates both of us as well. So please no one show Bret Hart this audio. Thank you, and please and thank you. So yeah, you had a lot of interesting candidates. Goldberg, the Von Erichs, JYD, Sarge, and Paul Orndorff's Mr. Wonderful. That's like a really good five, I think. I honestly don't see many flaws with that list there. You know, that's probably around the top five people. I think some people might cap for the Steiner brothers, you know, at the end of the day. But
is there enough – I think with the Steiners, there's not enough drawing evidence.
Yeah, I agree. Like, they were a great working team. I love their wrestling. Like, you know, when they were a team. But I agree that they didn't – the Von Erichs were bigger and more important to their company than the Steiners were, yes. I would say. So, yeah, good point there. Finally, Japan. Who were your picks here? I'll run through the candidates here. Riki Choshu, Animal Hamaguchi as a team. Shima, Tenkozy, Kojima and Tenzan. Yoshiaki Fujiwara, Hayabusa, Kota Ibushi. Antonio Inoki and Seiji Sakaguchi as a tag team. Tomohiro Ishii, Namichi Marufuji, Tetsuya Naito, Meiko Satomura, Shingo Takagi, 1987 Gold Combo, Manami Toyota, and Toshio Yamada, and the Holy Demon Army, Akira Taue, and Toshiaki Kawada. Who were your picks for the Japan region?
So I had, obviously, Holy Demon Army, Akira Taue, and Toshiaki Kawada, Shingo Takagi, Manami Toyota, and Toshio Yamada, Tomohiro Ishii, and Tetsuya Naito. Now, I'm willing to swipe out Ishii, possibly, for Hayabusa, because I know someone who is working on a Hayabusa piece about his drawing power, and I'm also willing to swap out Ishii for Shima, actually.
You know, it's going to be interesting, because we really went deep into Shima with me and Case. Hayabusa, legendary performer, I think drawing-wise, like, if you compare him to these modern guys, yeah. But also, I think it hurts that FMW went down with him on top compared to where it was with Onita. Like, I really don't see that as a positive. Because I think he's, like, a super like, his influence is among the top of anybody. You know, so I think that's really where his case lies. And he feels like a legend more than a lot of these other guys, like, especially the modern guys to me. So he ranks highly in my book. I think Fujiwara, I tried to sell Case on him earlier, and I will somewhat repeat it for you. Like, he was still drawing even into the 90s. Like, he was put in, he wasn't like a main event player for a long time, but when they would call upon him, he always had the respect of the fans. Even in 1993 G1, he main evented sumo hall shows in the G1. In 2001, he was the guy they turned to, the first ever Champion Carnival show post-split. He was in the main event versus Kawada, and they did a great number. He's a guy that was very influential, trained tons of different people. Like, the entire roster of Battle Arts was trained by him. Minoru Suzuki, Big Star, Masakatsu Funaki, Shinobu Kandori, one of the top Joshi stars. He trained all of them, was influential to all of them. I thought he was a great worker in the UWF and New Japan feud. He's one of the standout players. You know, had a great match with Inoki. Did a lot of good things. I understand that. I think a big knock against him is, oh, well, Takada and Maeda were ahead of him, which is true. But I also don't think that should disqualify Fujiwara, who's very influential. And to me, he checks all of the boxes. His one thing against him is that he was never heralded as a top star. It's just he was over and a draw because of respect that he could turn upon, but for whatever reason, he was never put in the top position of the company. But, I mean, if Ishii's on the ballot, then Fujiwara should be a credible person as well, in my opinion.
I can understand why Fujiwara's on the ballot. I would say, and I'm not a Fujiwara voter, but I will give him his props, that PWFG Tokyo Dome show Stack of Arms did a legitimate great number. It was reported in the Observer after it happened. They had a huge walk-up. So that's absolutely a feather in his cap. And you sort of brought up some of his other drawing. I just don't think it ultimately comes up enough to a Hall of Fame drawing record. Now, I agree I agree strongly with a lot of the shoot styles, the dead style. However, because I don't know how much you like to hear that. But the fact of the matter is it still has a influence on other Japanese promotions to this day. The fact of the matter of Baba going all to all clean finishes is because of shoot style. The fact that, you know, certain wrestlers obviously who came after have patterned their styles like that. Now, on the training front, he has quite an incredible, a pretty good training record. Although, if you look at the only person in the Hall of Fame as a trainer, although they're only in there as a trainer, it's Diablo Velasco.
Yeah, he's a luchador. Yeah.
Like, Atlantis, Gory Guerrero, Perro Aguayo, like, almost like Mil Mascaris, like, almost every major star in Lucha of, like, the last 50 years. So I don't think, you know, his training is quite impressive, but not up to that level. To me, it ultimately comes down to, it just doesn't, I don't think he's got the drawing thing.
I also think, again, it's not that I like shoot styles. It's not a relevant style anymore. Like, that's just a fact of the matter. It's not that I like hearing it or not. It just is. Like, it is what it is. There's nothing wrong with that. Again, like, wrestling changes, evolves. It's not, like, a bad thing or anything.
Well, but it did have a lasting impact that I think we should acknowledge, though, that doesn't necessarily get said when people say that it's, like, a style that's dead.
And we've said that for multiple people. Like, on there, like, he's the wrestler version of all this stuff we were saying about the non-wrestlers. Like, yes, they're not, like, that time has come and gone, but that doesn't mean the influence doesn't count either. Like, I think, like, because what it was very influential for decades at a time that you can point to. It just isn't happening now. And like I said, this to Case. My point against him is, like, so we're going to say all of these guys are these indie type of dudes, or your Marufujis, your Shimas, whoever is influential. What happens if 15 years from now, the style changes again, and there's no more high flying? Like, let's just say it all goes away, and the brawling returns, or there's something new that we don't even know about, or shoot style returns, like, who even knows? Does that take away from the influence that we have now, to which those guys are clearly very influential to wrestling? I think that it still would count for me 10 to 15 years from now, the same way that Fujiwara's influence counts for me even now, even though the shoot style is a dead style.
No, I think you've got it right there for the most part. Yeah, I mean.
But I am not the voter. You are the voter here, so let's talk about your candidates and why you went to them.
Well, I mean, Taui and Kawada is pretty obvious.
That to me is like the easiest. Like, to me, I'm sorry, Case, but everybody should vote for them. Like, I know every circumstance, they're the easiest candidate on the ballot. Like, there's no possible argument against them, in my opinion. It's like they are top tier at everything, and just to me, they're the best tag team of all time, legitimately. Like the number one team. You can argue some other teams. I'm not saying it's like slam, shut for them, but to me, they're number one, and I think anybody with any sense would have them at least up there in the roundabouts of that. So to me, they're like the easiest candidate on the whole region.
Yes, absolutely, and it's a combination of match quality and drawing as a tag team, too.
Yeah, and All Japan style was very influential, and they were a big part of it.
Yeah. I could talk about them for hours, but, like, there's not much to say within the Hall of Fame context. Like,
yeah, there's such strong candidates that there's, like, it would be easier to talk about any reasons why you wouldn't vote for him, of which there's none. Yeah, exactly.
Shingo Takagi. I think that some Dragon Gate guys, like, I think Dragon Gate's been overlooked, even if it's not my favorite style or something I've watched a lot of, especially in more recent years. I actually used to be really into Toriumon and, like, T2P Project when that started, but I guess I sort of just drifted away from that. But I think that Takagi has, I mean, to me, like, Takagi's on that Ishii level just in terms of, like, putting out incredible, like, wrestling for years and years, and someone who can match with anyone. And I think he's got some drawing records in Dragon Gate, and to a lesser extent, New Japan, although that's not his strongest suit, but I think it can be a bit of a help to him. I think, talking about Tomohiro Ishii on work, that should be also enough for Shingo Takagi. Has more here, so he has what Ishii has in work plus a little bit of drawing. So that's why I think he deserves.
Yeah, to me Shingo's an interesting case because he's a great performer. Like, as a wrestler, he's definitely up there as among the best. I think drawing power. I honestly don't think he's a Hall of Fame level guy. Shima to me would have more better case in terms of influence and drawing power. Like, both than him, but he's a better wrestler. Like, Shingo's a better wrestler than Shima, in my opinion. Like, I enjoy
him. He's better than peak Shima? Just out of curiosity, we don't have to get into a giant debate about that, but
I was a big fan of Shima, like, it is his peak. But, yeah, I think I would take Shingo. Stylistically, I think he appeals more. But, again, that's very, like, subjective, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
But they're both great, though. But I think Shingo's a better wrestler. But I think Shima is a better draw and influence. I think he's more influential than Shingo.
Yeah, I can agree with that, definitely. Obviously, like, everyone wanted to be.
And I don't think Shingo's as good of a wrestler as Ishii.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
No, I think Ishii's a much better wrestler, actually.
I think Oh, okay. Well, I think they're practically at the same level, like super elite.
I think until you see somebody like have the match that he had with Kanemaru in June, then Ishii's the best wrestler in New Japan, because he's the only one that can do that. At the end of the day.
Well, you know, you are Mr. Down on Kanemaru, whereas some of us are still Kanemaru partisans to this very day.
Well, okay, like, I liked his run in the Best of Super Juniors, but compare those matches to his match versus Ishii, and there's no comparison. Like, you know, like, Kanemaru was fine. Like, he's cool. Like, he's okay. I liked him a lot in Noah, but compare those matches in the Best of Super Juniors, any of his matches, to the Ishii match, and one stands out far, far more than the other sure. 10. So until Shingo can do that, and considering what he's doing with Phantasmo, which is absolutely awful, like I still will side with Ishii.
That's more of the angles as opposed to some of the match quality.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The match itself is just
it was okay. Ridiculous. Yeah. It's not like Shingo's a great wrestler. He's one of the top guys, but I think Ishii is at a completely different level than virtually everyone. Like just over the last. I mean, that's the thing. It's like a lot of his detractors will say Ishii, he had this brief run, but he's been around 9 years.
Well, I think Ishii's run is longer than that, actually.
Well, yeah, and he has a lot. Yeah, we talk about Ishii. But I think Ishii's a better, like, he's the top wrestler. Like I said, until somebody can do what he does every year in G1, then he's the best wrestler. And I don't think we've seen that yet. Even with Shingo, who had a great run, I didn't think he was, like, the blowaway standout of his block in G1 this year.
So, but do you think some that Dragon Gate guys are getting an unfair shake?
Like just of course.
I've been on the ballot over the years.
Oh, I think that anyone outside of New Japan is not getting a fair shake in terms of you know, like the voter results. I mean, look at last year with Sugira, even in Noah. I thought, you know, he should have been on the ballot. At least he shouldn't have fallen off if Mar Fuji's in. Dragon Gate, very influential. I think Shima and Shingo both belong on the ballot. Don't get me wrong. I definitely would consider them even. I just think that, you know, like I said, with Shingo, he doesn't feel like a legend to me. Like, again, that's kind of like this undescribable thing. He doesn't feel like a legend. And I think that that's true of all the modern candidates. As much as I love Ishii, I don't think I would vote for him for this. Just with things, although it's not that he doesn't have a case. They don't feel like legends to me. And I would vote for the legends over the guys that don't feel like legends, even if they have good parts about them. Like, you could definitely argue Shingo. What you said was all true. And in Dragon Gate, he was always a top star. He was always trusted. Even in New Japan, he rose up. And that was a big point Case made, is that he always overachieved from where you might think he would be. Because when he came into New Japan, I thought he would be at the Ishii level forever. Like, and the Goto type of level. You know, a guy that's, like, having great matches but never really pushed. But he became the champion.
See, I'm a little worried, though. Maybe this is I'm now giving reasons not to vote for him, that he is now at that level. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah. I think even his
on him in for an emergency.
Yeah.
And then that was his, like, gold watch.
Even in the title reign, to me, he's, like, in the exact same spot Jay is in this year, where his title reign was about he held it so Okada could win it at the Dome. And, like, that's what his title reign was ultimately really about, more than anything about him specifically.
Yeah. Well, without going into his side, and I know that, like, Jay White's not, like, someone you're a big fan of necessarily from a ring perspective, but, like, yeah, I mean, I just think that booking to have Okada win it back at the Dome is so boring. Where I almost think, well, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it because it's like an Inoki tribute show, but I think under other circumstances, Jay White should actually beat Okada at the Dome.
Yeah, we can have more like shows with thousands of less people, like they had with Tama Tonga.
Well, we don't know what Jay White's really. I'm just saying for freshening it up.
Well, we've been saying that for years, though, that it should be freshened up.
And you can have Jay lose it at the next month. I just think you need to.
No, I see where you're coming from. It's going to be tough. I mean, like, I was saying this 6 years ago, Gerard, like, I'd hear about Okada getting too pushed. But, like I said, I think ultimately these title reigns are not necessarily even about whatever, like, you love them or you hate them. I think this title reign is not about Jay. It's about Okada getting the win at the Dome. Like, that's how I felt about Shingo's title reign. It's like, and remember, he won, like, MVP votes, even in our awards, like the Eastern Lariat Awards. He got the most votes for, like, MVP. But to me, I was thinking, like, Okada was, like, that's who they see as the MVP, like, the company.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that that's an interesting thing. But like I said, it sounds like we're dogging Shingo, or I'm dogging Shingo, but I'm not. I love him as a wrestler. He's had amazing matches for his entire career. Even in Dragon Gate, his run with BB Hulk was what got me into Dragon Gate originally. Like, you know, it was him and Hulk. So, you know, I love him as a wrestler. I think he's not like some vote where I'm like, oh my God, how can you vote for like this guy? It's more like there are others I think feel more Hall of Fame worthy than him.
Okay. No, that's fair.
Yeah. But so it's not, I'm not trying to say like, oh no, you can't vote for him. It's just, you know, there's others that I think were more worthy, like your Hayabusas and your Fujiwaras. But that's just me. Like, yeah, like I said, I'm not the voter. You are the voter. So go on to whoever you want to talk about next.
Next, we got the 1987 gold combo, Minami Toyota and Toshio Yamada. I think that they are the third greatest tag team of all time. But unlike what I think is the second greatest tag team of all time, LCO, they have stronger drawing record than LCO, even if they weren't as long as LCO. And so to me, just like that, just their sheer level and that like series that they put on against Ozaki and Kanzai, just, you know, it's pure work and a little bit of drawing, but it just like I can't not vote for them.
Like I said on the other show, they have everything you want. Like, they are strong, like, A-plus candidates in all three categories, but they were only around for, like, 2 to 3 years. Like, so, like, that's going to be...
What, it was longer than that was.
92 to 94 was, like, them as, like, a true, like, main event level team. Like, their biggest run. I mean, they teamed, obviously, before and after that. But they really broke up when they lost the title in 94. They only had a few matches as, like, a tried-and-true team after that. Like, you know, in October 94. I cover this all again on the Patreon, the Toyota Tuesday series that I'm running on Patreon. But, like, they really didn't team as much after the 94. You had stuff like Tokyo Sweethearts with Toyota and Shimoda. You had Toyota and Hokuto have the run in the tag league and stuff like that. Toyota obviously was the main single star in 95 with the red belt and everything. You know, in 96, but really more so. So you get stuff there. But like I said, their main run as a team was 92 and 94, I would say. Right there, through 94.
But they've got gates and business that LCO never did, and they're almost as good.
They're a better Hall of Fame team than LCO. Like in every way. Like I love LCO, don't get me wrong. We were talking off the air, I'm gonna try and probably push them for the ballot. Yeah. But to me, like, okay, they built a years-long feud, like 3 years-long feud between Aja Kong and Bull Nakano over the red belt. And during the climactic finish of that, where Kong finally beat Bull and won the title, Toyota and Yamada were the main event, like over the red belt match, facing Kanzai and Ozaki. The amazing Shinobu Kandori and Akira Hokuto brawl that everyone loves, Toyota and Yamada were the main event over that one. And so it's like... And they were facing people from smaller companies, by the way, like against JWP, not who was a smaller company than All Japan Women's. So they to me are like, they have, and there are some of, and they, like their work is some of the greatest of all time. To me, they're.
I guess it's the thing with JYD. It's like the highs are so high, even if it was short.
Exactly. And not to mention their work against each other as tag team champions and like as a tag team was like a legendary feud that got directly ripped off 30 years later.
Well, see, here's the interesting thing that some of us were discussing. If the tag team breaks up and their feud draws, does that count towards the tag team?
And they didn't even break up.
And I think it should.
Yeah, I agree. Even if they did break up, I would still agree with that it should. But in that case, it was a very unique case in that they were actually a tag team directly, even though they were feuding. It's just their feud – this was like great booking, honestly, that you probably wouldn't see today. But they had a match every year, a singles match against each other every year for 4 years straight. And all 4 years were draws, like time limit draws. And then they finally had one at Yamada 1, like in June 1992. And that drove Toyota nuts, even though they were tag team at the time. And Toyota challenged her to a hair versus hair match. And that's like a legendary match at Angle. As I said, that was like directly influenced even in Stardom 30 years later. In the Tom Nakano and Julia match, they did the exact same finish. Or not the finish of the match, but the post-match, they did the exact same angle. And I think it made Toyota kind of mad. Like, actually.
Toyota gets mad about a lot of things being repeated.
She has a high opinion of herself, okay? Listen right now.
As she should.
Yes, as she should. Completely correct. One of the greatest ever. But yeah, to me, it's like they're a slam dunk candidate, especially if you count the single stuff, they're like one of the top candidates on any region. If you don't count it, they're still a yes to me pretty easily.
Yeah. I'm not particularly confident in their chances, to be honest, though.
It's going to be I think that they're a very interesting thing because I could see it going either way, to be honest with you. Like, I could see them getting votes and support because Toyota's such a legend. And especially, you have to remember, this is the Observer Hall of Fame. And it's like Okada. You know, in my opinion, you should wait for people to get older so we see more of their legacy. But in the Observer lineage, Okada's like one of the top people. And among women's wrestlers, Toyota's among the top people in history of the Observer lineage. So I think that will carry them to somewhat. I don't think they'll fall off the ballot. Let me put it that way, like Sugira did that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that, like, I think that All Japan Women could win awards in the Observer was Dave, like, promoting it, basically.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I don't think they'll fall off the ballot. I don't know I don't think they'll get in, per se, but I think that they have a chance to at least make a little bit of a splash. Like, we will see what happens. But I do think that they're worthy votes, let's put it that way.
Yeah. So next up, I've got Tomohiro Ishii. And I need to tell you, the first time I ever saw Ishii would have been in around 01 and 02 in Michinoku Pro, where he was. Sort of
facing Gaida.
Yeah, after war went defunct. I wish, in an alternate universe, that Tenryu had brought him with him to All Japan. Because that would have been incredible.
Ishii in All Japan? That would have been really cool. Actually, like, that would have been interesting.
But I followed Ishii's career through World Japan, and then him eventually getting into New Japan, because Riki Choshu decided that he no longer thought indies were below him. And so he started to work with and brought them in Japan when he got the book back in whatever it was, 05, 06? Was.
Yeah, that was around 06. Simon brought him back in.
Yes. And so I think that Ishii, like, popped off the screen to me ever since I first saw him in Michinoku Pro, and I'd argue that he's maybe he peaks in, like, he starts his peak in 2011 or 2012, but I think you could make a case of him being, like, one of the 25 greatest wrestlers in the world. Just from a work rate perspective, going back to the early 2000s, I really do.
And that's interesting, because I think the thing against him isn't necessarily like
no one saw him.
Yeah. And
I was the only person buying World Japan tapes.
Hey, listen, there's nothing wrong with this. I love the support for Riki Choshu, an all-time legend. So we will not trash talk World Japan on this show. But he never got those opportunities to be in big major matches. More so than anything wrong with him as a wrestler, he just didn't have the opportunities that a lot of these other guys would have. And, you know, it's like, because remember, that era, I mean, we were looking at a really strong era of wrestling, you know, like looking at the Noah feud, New Japan has some great wrestlers, you know. I think that it's a really interesting time period. And Mexico was really thriving in terms of in-ring work, too. You had, like, Rey Bucanero and Ultimo Guerrero as, like, an amazing tag team. Shocker was still a great wrestler. Atlantis was big. It's like you had a lot of different guys in different situations. But Ishii, to me, I honestly, I've seen a good amount of his matches that he's had there. Not in total, but I've seen a few of his matches. Like, you could say a dozen, whatever. He was really a good wrestler. Like, he had matches against, like, Sekimoto in Big Japan, even in the mid-2000s. He had the match versus Gaina in Michinoku Pro that you mentioned. Did stuff in World Japan. You might be better at to talk about than me.
There wasn't much of Ishii. Ishii certainly did not get to show off his skills that much in World Japan.
Yeah, but he had a few matches, like a couple, a handful, you know, you can point out. You know, but to me, it's like, I can't really buy that as him as a top-tier worker until we saw him get more. It's not, again, nothing against him. It's just the opportunities that didn't come his way until, you know, 10 years later, pretty much.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, I am willing to remove Ishii for Hayabusa or Shima. I have not made a final decision on that.
Do you think that losing his hair to Tiger Mask, did that influence you in any way? Do you think he looks better with the hair or without the hair?
Well, I first saw him with hair, so like yeah. I don't think it's as jarring as it would be for someone that started watching New Japan in like 20 something.
Right. On there. But yeah, then he had his major run, which I think everybody knows about. I kind of made the case that I think he's underrated, actually, as an influence and even a draw. Like, he never got the opportunities, really. Again, like, that's the thing with him. It's like, if he had been pushed like he was in 2012 and 2002, he probably would be considered up there as like a legendary performer all of those years. And the thing with the draw is, when he was pushed, like, the rare times he was in main events, he did good. Like, he succeeded any test you put in front of him. Like, challenging Naito for the title, the G1 main events, main eventing the secondary shows as never champion, they were always in his favor. And I always say that he's a guy that's one of the most in-demand wrestlers in terms of outside of Japan. He's one of the guys they always turn to, is Ishii.
For sure. Absolutely. Did his match, his title match against Omega draw?
What title was that?
IWGP Destruction 2018.
Ishii faced Omega for the title?
Yeah, because
Ishii, I don't even remember that.
G1 in that incredible match.
Oh, man, I wish I could remember this, to be honest with you. How did I forget about that match?
Let me just see here. I think it was the Kobe show.
Who did he beat that he never got a title shot for? His well-deserved title shot that I will never, ever forget. Like, his well-deserved title shot, he's never gotten it. Why has he not gotten it?
Was it Okada, right?
I think it probably was Okada. I think that was probably Okada. 2016 or something, probably. He still deserves a title shot. I don't care how long it's been.
Destruction in Hiroshima. Only 3,761, which is not bad, but...
Yeah, to be honest, I totally blanked on this until you did, so that,
well,
that's...
Well, here's the thing. I thought their G1 match was incredible.
Yeah.
The title match wasn't as good because...
That's right.
I wanted to, like, stretch it out and, like, get all more melodramatic instead of just throwing bombs at each other.
The G1 match was a great match. And I think they had a match in, like, the New Japan Cup or something, too, earlier in the year. Earlier in the year, they had a singles match, which was, like, really good, too.
And then they had that match, I think it was in the finals of the U.S. tournament.
Yeah, that was another one that they had there. So, yeah, Ishii. But the fact of the matter is, despite all of that, I think that you can't say he has a Hall of Fame record as a draw. I just think that, like, people talk about him like he's a complete zero. And he's like...
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like, I think he deserves a little more respect, is all I'm saying. I'm not trying to say, oh, he's a Hall of Fame star. I think he's an interesting case, and I like that he's on the ballot, to be honest with you, because he ultimately is a complete mid-card guy. And we are going to see how that handles, because he ultimately is a work rate candidate purely. He's not a Hall of Fame guy in terms of draw power, or definitely not star power. I do think he's influential as well in the ring, and I made this point as well. Compare Goto and Shibata before Ishii's push to when they started wrestling him and how they wrestled after. Shibata, his first run and during Laughter 7 when they came in, was a completely different wrestler compared to how he wrestled after he faced Ishii and went to that never scene. It's like he influenced multiple guys, even in his own company, which then led to other people getting influenced all over the world. I think if you ask a lot of fans, if you say, who is the strong style wrestler of New Japan? Ishii would be the majority vote. Like, he's kind of who they see as that hard-hitting style guy.
Definitely.
I think he's an underrated influence, like, even more than the drawing power, to be honest. But in the end, it's like an in-ring is going to be his calling card at the end of the day. And I think, to me, he's the best wrestler in New Japan. Like, in-ring, kind of what I said earlier. And I think, if anything, too, another point I made, I think he was an underrated draw for the start of the G1s before New Japan World Era, when they had it on Ustream, because Dave would always push his matches, and I think he was one of the top stars of the G1 to Western fans and really helped sell a lot of pay-per-views with his matches specifically.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I like him as a vote. Like, again, he doesn't feel like a legend, but I don't disagree with your voting for him. So, Shingo, to me, is a better all-around candidate, but Ishii would be the better worker.
Yeah. And, finally, he's the final one. Tetsuya Naito. Funny, because I could probably say a few things about him that are not so positive. Like, I think if you look at between Okada, Tanahashi, Ishii, bracket out Nakamura. But I think he's the least consistent from an in-ring standpoint.
Yeah, I agree with that. Of the Okada, Ibushi, Tanahashi, and him, he's the fourth on the total pole.
I might even dare say that I did like his series against Tanahashi in 2017 for the IC title, if that's right.
Yeah.
That series, I might like more than Okada and Tanahashi.
I made this same point with Case, man. Like, I love that series of matches. Naito and Tanahashi was an all-time great rivalry, very underrated in-ring feud.
So I'm not saying he's a bad wrestler at all. He's incredible, but I just wanted to point that out because I'm going to talk something about it, something in a second.
You're a hater, Gerard. Well, you're trying to disrespect him. Let's just be honest.
Well, no.
I'm just kidding.
Naito fans get really well. I was going to get to this, but I'll just do it now. Naito fans get really upset about this if they feel like he's being disrespected.
And this is kind of a point I'm making with Case again. It's like, I think that's something that could be considered kind of a check in his favor. Cause I feel the same way about like CM Punk fans in America, where it's like, if you are a fan of Tetsuya Naito, you love Tetsuya Naito. Like you're not just a fan. It's like he's an automatic legend. And like you said, if there's any negative on him, even if it's like not that bad, people will take any slight as like a big,
so I guess now I know some people that really don't like him. I like him, but I am not some like,
yeah,
ride or die Naito.
Yeah, we're more in between, but probably like a thumbs up. But we just he's not one of our
greatest favorites. Wrestlers of the last decade for sure.
One of the most popular for sure.
Oh well, that's really the feather in his cap. The drawing and the merch. I think the merch should count in it.
Yeah, I mean that made the company a ton of money. Like that's the one thing you can never take away from him is his merch sales in LIJ.
I think he's sort of. Do you think he's done in the main events? Like, there's not much for him left to sort of add to his resume that he's going to end up doing.
I think that perhaps I feel like he's definitely done as like the guy like that could have been, and which he never really actually got to be. I think that's like a huge black mark on Gato as a booker, is that he was never given a real run. You know, and I think if he had been a top star for like, he had a real long-term run. It's like not only his IWGP title reigns were like one defense each. Five of his six Intercontinental title reigns was only one defense or zero defenses. It's like he never got to be a top star for a
Some people will argue that there are certain wrestlers in that role like that are fit for that role, like a Dusty Rhodes, who's always a chase and never the champion for very long.
Yeah, that's kind of part of his gimmick, is that like he's not the favorite of the company. You know, that's a big part of why he's so popular, is that he's not the chosen one like Okada is. He's the unchosen one. I wrote an article a few years ago about comparing him to Kawada, who had a very similar run in All Japan until like the Muto era, where he got that one. He finally did get that long title reign, but before that, he was always like the one who had a really short title reigns, was never able to be that guy, and you could see that was a part of his gimmick. And I think that Naito made that a part of his as well in LIJ.
Well, yeah, and then Kawada had an incredible title run, so you know maybe
Naito didn't have that.
Naito has one, but I think Naito could have had one in him. Maybe.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like I said, I think that's a major, major black mark against Gato, is that they squandered, like not squandered, but they never did what they could have done with him. I think it's safe to say with Naito.
I also did some digging on Naito's voting from last year, and I find Naito so fascinating because he's so slam dunk, but he also seems so polarizing to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
2021, he got 38% among everyone. He was 27th among historians. He finished 11th quarters, but he was 28th among active wrestlers / industry professionals, and he didn't even chart, so he would have been lower than 30, higher than 30 for retired wrestlers. Does that tell you anything?
That's interesting. I think the reporters would have looked at his drawing numbers, and I think he is not.
And they also follow him in real time.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point as well. You know, and I think that's the thing. And this is kind of the
28 among active wrestlers is interesting.
Yeah, you would think he's a big, you know, he's a big name to active guys.
Because we know a lot of those guys. I don't know how many. Like, I don't know if any Japanese wrestlers vote. I know historians and reporters do. Japanese historians and reporters vote, but I don't know if any Japanese wrestlers.
Tanahashi, who are you voting for? Let us know. Like,
but that being said, there's enough active wrestlers in North America that you know are watching.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And he's one of the top stars there.
So I'm a little surprised at the active thing.
Well, when you think about it, when you look at the style, he's not as influential as a lot of these other guys. Like, to the American style, I don't feel like. Like, just in-ring, like, I don't feel like a lot of people take from him the way they do other people, like Okada or Tanahashi or even Ishii. Do you sense there's, like, a Naito wrestling style that's, like, made its way to America on a bigger scale? Because I really don't. Yeah.
But do you think luchadors would be a bigger fan of him?
Yeah, he was super over in Mexico, and like a lot of his gimmick was taken. His original, yeah, Ingobernables was in Mexico, and, like, and he kind of took that a lot from Sombra and Rush and all of that, and made it his own, obviously. So that's interesting.
AEW superstar Rush.
Yeah, yes, the good guy of the Ingobernables in AEW as well, Rush, good guy Rush. But that's an interesting point there. How that would go, and we don't know how many Mexican wrestling like luchadors are voting either. So that would be an interesting case if you.
So I just find it interesting who is so. I'm not even going to say anti-Naito, but just doesn't register for them.
And listen, there's a lot more voters in the reporter category. I mean, like look at yourself, right? Like right now, like you're in there this year, and you weren't around like in years past. And I think more and more people of our era, so to speak, are now getting votes in that followed Naito in real time. And I think we respect his drawing power and respect even his wrestling. Even if, like us who are not like his biggest fans, we still respect his wrestling and know that he's really good. You know, I think we might have a little bit more of an edge as the reporter category than the wrestlers.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can absolutely put, even though I say he's like was the fourth best of them, you can absolutely put his work into the discussion of.
I think the thing with him is when he's motivated and the stars are aligning, he's great.
Yeah,
but that doesn't happen that much, to be perfectly honest with you, especially anymore because his body's broken down. You know, like he's had a lot of injuries. He's not where he was, you know, even 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Well, and some of that, you know, I'll say this, because Meltzer had the narrative that, like Naito was constantly on the verge of death or something. Like.
Hey, well, I mean, that's a little dramatic. We've seen people work the injuries time and time again, pretty much in New Japan. But still, though, he's not where he was. Like, it's very obvious to see that. And I think I actually think motivation is more of a problem than injury. I think he doesn't feel like he's doing a lot of important stuff lately. And that's why you see a lot of stuff. Even in that G1, I thought he really didn't get into the next gear until the end. You know, like the first few matches, I thought he was pretty sluggish, to be honest. And then he really turned it up for a big match or two by the end. But I think that's kind of his story, is that if he's doing something that he's really into, he could be super great. But a lot of times if he's not, and they haven't really pushed him to that level constantly to where he is, I think that you'll see his work. And like someone like an Ishii will be a great wrestler in the 6-man tag, you know, like the tag titles. Yeah. I don't think you can say that for a Naito.
Of course. Was he the first guy to do the t-shirt thing?
He's definitely the one that I think popularized it. Because that was popular a lot in Lucha, though. Like, long before Naito, like, people would wrestle in their shirts. Even, like, Sombra himself was a big proponent of that, where, you know, if it's a random 6-man, you wouldn't always go full out. You might wrestle in the shirt for it. And for Naito, that means not good effort when he wrestles in the shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, because I just thought this was an interesting talking point, because I think there's a little bit of, I don't know, over-dramatic stuff about some of his defenders of, like, you know, this is absolutely scandalous. I think there's some mixed stuff, but even though I really do think he should be in.
I think that, like I said, I wish that they had pushed him more so we could have seen a true run on the top. That's the only thing missing from him. I think if he had that run, he'd be a slam dunk candidate to everybody. Like, I think he would have had a huge, and we saw that even that match with Kenta before everything happened when he first won the title, that did way better than expected numbers at the New Beginning.
Oh, yeah, so, that was huge.
Yeah, and like, you know, that did way better than expected. And I think if that had continued on, he would have had an amazing run. I know people will say, oh, the pandemic shortened it, but the fact of the matter is he's had it multiple times and the same thing happened every time. You know, at the end of the day, it wasn't like this just magically happened. And I also think, like, to me, him not winning over Okada in the Dome the first time was one of the biggest fumbles that I can remember. Like, and it led to that Omega run, which wasn't that great, on top of it. And he left the company after, which made it even worse, and it wasn't even that good to begin with. But I thought that was, like, one of the hugest screw-ups of all time. Like, even the crowd reaction, I still remember that. As soon as that win, you'll never see something go dead silent as when Okada won that match.
Yeah, I mean, So, I mean, Ghetto would tell you that, well, it paid off with his two-day domes. Or at least the first time they did it, it was...
And his title win was 10,000 less than the match before with Ibushi and Okada.
I don't think that's purely Naito's fault. That's
No, it's not at all. But it's the two-night thing is the reason why. Like, if they had just done a Naito title match, I think it would have been, you know, just as huge, if not bigger, than the first night.
People sit in the aisle ways like Inoki's retirement.
I don't know about that, but like I said, I think it would have been a big show, to say the least. I think it would have been bigger than it turned out to be. Like, the second night really wasn't that great of an idea. Even though, I mean, like I said, for them, they'll be like, yeah, well, we drew 70,000 over two nights. But still, though, like, I think that the moment wasn't as big as it could have been. But to his fans, it was like the greatest moment in history. Like, him winning the title at the Dome.
I guess I'll ask you this wrap up because...
Yeah.
You know, it never really popped into my head, and now I'm sort of like, I think it's probably because he's sort of out of sight, out of mind right now, but like, vote for Ibushi?
I think I honestly think his total is going to like plummet this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, regardless of whether you think he should go in or not, just disappearing is going to hurt him.
And like, to me, it's like, it's hard for me to ignore. Like I said, Naito, his runs were short because of bad booking. Ibushi's run was like an astronomical flop, like in his biggest run of his career, and it's hard for me to separate that, even though he, like, if you look at everything besides that, he was always a name on the indie level, and even in New Japan, and he's an amazing wrestler, in my opinion. Like, his match versus Tanahashi is one of the best, like, the G1 final, that's one of the best New Japan matches I've ever seen, in my opinion. Like, to me, he's an incredible wrestler. It's just, you know... He doesn't feel like a legend. It's like, it's the same way with all of these guys to me. It's like, they don't feel like legends to me. And that's hard for me to overcome. And I think his run being so bad, and now things have really gone off the rails in New Japan with all the controversy. And like you said, just disappearing. I think he's going to have a real tough go of it this year.
Yeah, I agree. But like, part of me sort of wants to like, hope for him, but I just can't do it right now.
Yeah, he has a case. I mean, his work and you know, and everything. Again, I think the influence-wise, he would be somebody you would look more towards a Shima or even a Marufuji, I think, would be considered more influential than Ibushi. In a lot of ways, I think Ibushi had to – and it was kind of a point I was going to make on Takagi, actually, when I was reading your article. Ibushi had to get rid of the DDT stuff when he went to New Japan. Like, he's a much different wrestler now than he was when he was in DDT. So he's, it's not like, I don't really consider him that influential, but he's just a great wrestler.
You can argue that Kenny Omega did not get rid of some of the DDT stuff when he went to Japan.
Yeah. And I mean,
hurt him.
Well, it hurt him to me, but I think that if you're going to say someone is, but I think Omega is influential, even though it's negative to me. I think wrestlers take after him a lot. Yeah, so like to me, he would count as an influencer more than Ibushi, who I think is just, again, a tremendous wrestler. And I like him a lot, honestly. I think he's a great performer. I just, you know, I would like to see where these guys are in 5 years' time. Because if he stays away forever, then he's not getting in. Like, you know, like that's just all there is to it.
I think he'd have to come in and have another title run if you really want.
Yeah, he would have to have a redemption arc, and if you do that, I think that would be a great money-making thing that could happen, too, if they wanted to go there. And that's what, if I was Kidani or whoever, I'd be like, look, we need to stretch all this aside and get Ibushi back into the fold, because I think people would actually be more on his side, because remember when all that double title stuff happened, the fans totally turned on him in Japan. And like I said, things really turned bad in that title reign, and they had to, you know, abort mission right away, you know, by the end of it. I think if he came back and had a run to the title, I think the fans would rally behind him because of everything that's happened, and like very publicly.
For sure.
Yeah, so he's an interesting case to look for in the future, and this is why I kind of wish that we could wait for the guys, because I think in 3 to 4 years, we'll have much more clarity on his run. And for even someone like an Ishii or a Shingo, let's say they have 5 more years of amazing matches. Then that becomes that much harder to, you know, say, oh, well, they shouldn't be a Hall of Famer when they're like, they've established themselves firmly as like the, you know, some of the greatest in-ring wrestlers of all time.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting. But overall, you made a good case, and I loved having you on, man. It was so fun to talk to you about all of this stuff on the Observer Hall of Fame. It's something I wanted to do. I did like a very small show on the Patreon last year after the Hall of Fame happened, just going over stuff. And I remember you said something like you wanted to talk about it. So I was very much looking forward to having you on. And we covered everything that we could pretty much. I really enjoyed it, man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I had an absolute blast, and like even just sort of helping clarify some of my own thinking about like my like final when I really finalized my ballot too.
I was just making stuff up. Don't listen to me. No, no, I'm just kidding. But hopefully everybody else enjoyed it. Again, this is something new. We never really broached the Hall of Fame in any noteworthy fashion before on the Eastern Lariat. It's just something different for everybody. I don't know if everybody's going to be super into it, but like I said, I think that more than anything, the talk of the people is like better. Like that's the main draw to me of the Hall of Fame, is like talking about these legends. Look at that conversation we just had about all those guys. I think that's very fun and useful, I would say. So I really appreciate it. Man, Gerard, I'm a big fan of your show, the Emerald Flow Show, and I noticed that you've been doing a lot of writing lately, both in the Hall of Fame sense, but you also done some stuff with All Japan as well. So why don't you talk to the people about this, man?
Okay, so you can listen to my podcast, The Emerald Flow Show, at Emerald Flow Show on Twitter. We talked about it, but like I've got stuff on Chanchiro Takagi and Tiger Jeet Singh up at Voices of Wrestling. And right now I just launched yesterday a new series that'll be about five parts. It's called All Japan 50 for 50. Basically one match, it'll be go by the decades. It'll be one match from each year of the promotion in its existence. I will try to have a link to the match, although that gets a little dicier after 2000. So I cannot make no guarantees for any post Noah split matches to be
the honest. Dark Ages.
there's a few stuff. Gaora's actual official YouTube site has uploaded a good number of them, but I can't guarantee that all of thing after 2000 will be up there. And there's just a sort of brief write up about sort of the significance of them all. Like I can't not put up like Kawada versus Misawa for 1994. But like in some of the stuff I'm trying to get maybe something a little more outside the box where I can. Something that, you know, people may have been much less likely to see. So, you know, that whole collection, and I think it really will highlight just how influential and how many changes that have happened to the promotion over the years.
Yeah, I think it's a really awesome project. When you told me about it, I was like, man, this is great. I mean, for 50 years, I mean, there was like a couple I mentioned to you, but for the most part, probably at least 40 to 45 of them of the 50 was like, that's what I would have picked, you know, pretty much on them. I thought you did a heck of a job curating the list, and I think everybody's really going to enjoy that as well. And you're always doing reviews for stuff, too. You even reviewed the All Japan show.
Yeah, I got a review of Takao Mori versus Kento Miyahara up on the website now, too. So
he may not have won the title, but he still has the best theme. Okay.
Absolutely.
But yeah, like you're always doing stuff, writing reviews for All Japan. Noah, when they do big shows, maybe you'll check out if Fujita wins the title on that.
No, because sometimes it's also fun to watch a promotion just...
Yeah, and plus the reaction will at least be fun, if that happens.
I actually said this on the last time of the Emerald Flow show. Noah has done some really stupid things, but that's a level of stupidity that I don't think they're going to go.
Yeah, I actually feel the exact same way. Like it's like I know that it's possible, but in my mind, like,
Do that, Kaido walks. I would hope he walks.
But it's just like my mind can't comprehend it even happening. It's like does not compute flashes when I even think of something like that happening. But like I said, it would be amusing to say the least. We will see what happens. But Noah, they'll have some good stuff, sure. You know, I'm sure on the show as well. All Japan doing some good things. It feels like they've had a good run ever since the best band ever and the theme song of the Hall of Fame shows, Shingeki, has showed up as well. I think that was a major turning point. And much like Bobby Davis investing in Wendy's, I think Shingeki should be a Hall of Fame candidate if All Japan keeps turning their fortunes around. They did a big number too on this show recently.
Yeah, that's really good to see. So,
Yeah, yeah. So good stuff there. Like I said, you do great work. I'm a big fan of yours, to be honest, just on a personal level. So everybody check his reviews out. Check out Imran Flow Show. Him and Paul do some good work on there. Maybe I'll show up again one of these days.
Definitely. We'll have to have you at some point again, for sure.
Yeah, if I haven't read you off already from me. I think the first show was the end of the line. But I represented the sponsors on the show, so I think that gives me some love on there.
Absolutely.
Thank you to everybody. First of all, thank you, Gerard, for coming on again. I really appreciate it. Then thank you guys, all the listeners out there, for supporting the Eastern Lariat. Follow us on Twitter at Eastern Lariat. Your Twitter handle is Imran Flow Show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Follow them on there. Follow their show. They're doing great things. They're always talking stuff too on there as well on their Twitter. I'm at Viva_0. Follow us on all of our links and stuff on the iTunes, your Stitchers, your Spotify's, everywhere podcasts are heard. All that stuff there. Follow us on Patreon, patreon.com/EasternLariat. Oh, we also got the rollover pricing too, so you're not going to get charged twice anymore. They stopped screwing everybody over, which I appreciated that because I was very annoyed at that when I saw it. So thank you for that, Patreon. But most importantly, keep your eyes peeled. We're going to do some more stuff in the future for the Hall of Famer. We got I'm trying to get some people on for the Lucha scene. I will see if I can do it. That might be a Patreon exclusive show, actually, because we'll see what happens on that end. But I wanted to do things for everybody, and it's great to see the new people, the new blood coming into the voting pool of the Hall of Fame. Like I said, it's a new thing for us. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Let me know if you will, because if this may be a yearly thing going forward, if it gets over with the fan base, and if everyone hates it, let me know as well. I will try to pretend I never did this in coming years going forward. But I think it was fun, though, for me personally. I really love doing it. Love talking to Case, and definitely you as well, Gerard. So with that said, thank you to all the fans out there. And as always, you know I love you. Until next time, sayonara.
This is Dave and Nick. Listen to the bid. Bring a party hall, talking yo, what a red red. Bring a party hall, what it. ふざけた視線の変化してくばい自由への合図
評論は俺を離婚なんてもう嫌だ。生きたまま